What else would you call me?
Good morning. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary to order.
Call the House Committee on Judiciary to order.
So good morning or good afternoon to everyone for being here today. We have a very full agenda. We're going to start off with the informational meeting portion, and we're going to have a role play that's going to occur that's going to be put on by some individuals that have been coordinated by, and I hate to try to give credit to everyone, so those who put this together, thank you very much. And let's see, Judge Leonard, I know that you are going to kind of give us an overview to get us started. And what I'm going to just say for those, we have a few members that had been tied up in other meetings and functions. They will be coming in as they complete. And so we apologize that we couldn't have everyone here at the very beginning, but we want to get you started so we won't run out of time. Judge Leonard.
Thank you, Senator, and members of the committee. Thank you very much for allowing us some time on your busy agenda today to give you a skit that relates to juvenile dependency work. And it'll become self-explanatory in a moment. But I want to provide a little bit of information about how this group comes to you today. And this is a project that has been produced by the Juvenile Dependency Interbranch Work Group that has now been in existence for, I guess, the last 3 or 4 years. I joined it a couple of years ago, and it was really the through the energy and the creation of the work by Chief Judge Dave Brewer of the Court of Appeals, who would be here today, but he's a bit under the weather, and Representative Krieger has really been the moving forces behind this work group. And Representative Stiegler has been a valuable part of that, and Senator Cruz and pardon me if I get it wrong, is it Representative Schaffler or Senator?
Yes.
Thank you. And we have provided you a packet. It's the purple folder that you have before you some information that relates directly to the skit that we are going to be presenting, and also a bit about the work group itself. And there's a white piece of paper that is two-sided that gives an overview of what the work group has been doing in the area of juvenile dependency. And I think everybody on this committee believes that there really isn't any work that is any more important than work in the area of child dependency and child and family welfare. And what this work group is doing is to establish some priorities to assist you this session in identifying matters in the world of child dependency, to help you shape policy and make some decisions as you go through this difficult session. We're not here asking you for money. We are here to provide information we hope to be a resource during the session, and you can call upon us if you would like information or suggestions or review of matters that might come before you in the world of dependency. It's an interbranch group. There are representatives from the judicial branch, from the legislature, and from the executive branch. I think it's a very well-informed committee and with a lot of information at its disposal. With that, let's move to the skit that we are going to present, and it is going to take you through a typical child dependency case in a very abbreviated, compact fashion. And we have a cast of exceptional thespians here behind me, and I'm sure you'll appreciate their ability as we go through this skit. I would like to make a couple of introductions. There are more introductions than we have time for, but I would like to introduce some people that are very influential in this discipline. Nan Waller, Judge Nan Waller from Multnomah County, is to your right, and she, I'm sure, is familiar to many of you. She's done a lot of work down here and is an expert in this area. Judge Pamela Abernathy behind her from Marion County, and who is equally regarded in the world of child dependency. Behind me is Senior Judge Becky Orff, who is also with the JASIP project, and doing work for the judicial branch. And behind me in the black suit is Dr. Phil Fisher. Dr. Fisher is a professor at the University of Oregon and also a research scientist at the Oregon Social Learning Center in Eugene, and brings considerable knowledge in areas involving child dependency work, child development, family dynamics, and he is going to add some commentary to this skit as it's presented. And he is highly regarded in his field, and in fact is going to be using the videotape of this proceeding for a work group that he is part of at Harvard University that is, among other things, one of their missions is to try to disseminate best practices information, policy information, to decision makers such as yourselves. And I think we're very lucky to have Dr. Fisher with us today. I know I saw Representative Krieger wanted to make a comment probably about the work group, and I will shut up and look to Representative Krieger to perhaps add a little bit, and I want to compliment him for all the hard work and the dedication he's given to this very valuable project.
Over the last 2-3 years, we've found that the representation of the attorneys for the families, kids, grandmothers, the time spent has always been lacking. I see these attorneys that are representing these people, and my question is, have they properly prepared themselves by spending the proper amount of time to represent their clients?
Well, for those that actually have children, they probably are qualified on a day-to-day basis, and I trust the rest of them probably have. I'm not sure if we have the child here or not today. If we do, we'll send them home with them.
All right. The last thing I need to do before we get started with the skit is I have to have a PSA here for our attorneys. If you're here and if you want to get CLE credit, knowing that some of us are actually reporting this time, there is a sign-up sheet over on the little side table for your name and rank bar ID number, and you will be able to get credit once it's qualified and by the state bar. But with that, the PSA is done.
Thank you.
Your Honor.
Good afternoon. I'm going to be your narrator and provide some of the context for our play and speed us along through the life of the dependency case that you're about to see. Today you're going to hear about Chris Jones and Sally Lewis, who have two children, Justin, age 2, and Jason, age 5. Chris was convicted of delivery of a controlled substance a year ago and sentenced to 24 months incarceration. His former partner, Sally Lewis, is raising their two children. She's also raising Jennifer, age 15, her teenage daughter from a previous relationship. Jennifer is struggling with drug abuse and emotional problems, staying away from home for days at a time and out of her mother's control. A phone call is made to Child Welfare Hotline alleging Ms. Lewis is using methamphetamine and that her son Jason is wandering around the neighborhood unattended and asking neighbors for food. Given the meth allegations, and Child Welfare contacts law enforcement and a caseworker and a police officer respond to the home. As you can see from the assessment referral in your packets, and it's in the purple folder, this is a complex family system that has not previously been involved with the child welfare system. All children in the household must receive an assessment. The information gathered during the 30 to 60 day assessment process will lead to an assessment conclusion by child welfare and will point to a direction for an action plan and services for the family. Caseworkers must complete their child safety assessment while working parallel with a possible criminal investigation conducted by law enforcement. It is not uncommon for there to be a substantiated child abuse assessment and for law enforcement to drop criminal charges. One action does not necessarily stop the other from moving forward, since there are different legal standards for child protective services and criminal prosecutions. But since the factual and legal issues overlap, one of the cases may be postponed until the other is resolved. In some counties, parents with both dependency cases and criminal cases are represented by the same lawyer in both matters. In other counties, there are separate attorneys for each case who must coordinate with each other. When the officer and caseworker arrive at Sally's home, the officer makes several observations, including that the house is in extremely poor condition. There is garbage everywhere, no food in the kitchen, and there is a foul odor in the house with dirty clothing and clutter everywhere. They also see beer cans and drug paraphernalia in the house. The officer sees a plastic baggie of white crystalline powder on the coffee table. The caseworker and the police officer find that the conditions reasonably appear to jeopardize the children's welfare. And so event one is the removal.
Ms. Lewis, you're under arrest for unlawful possession of a controlled substance.
Where's your daughter?
I don't know. She comes and goes.
Well, where does she go to school?
School? I can't make her go to school.
Is there a relative who can care for the children, or could they stay with the boy's father?
No.
There will be a juvenile court hearing for the children tomorrow morning. We will arrange to have you transported there from jail if you're still in custody, so you can participate in the planning for your children.
The officer takes mother to jail. The worker takes the two younger children to a foster home. The officer writes a report describing her observations, which is sent to child welfare for the juvenile court shelter hearing. A search is initiated for Jennifer.
Hello, Mrs. Smith. Thank you so much for your willingness to care for Justin, Jason, and Jennifer, if we're able to locate Jennifer. Let's sit down and talk about the background information I have been able to find on the children and their current needs. They have not been in here before, and I have only been able to talk to one relative, so I'll be providing you additional information as I get it. And I would appreciate you letting me know how the children are doing and any special needs you observe. I will also leave a packet of information. Please call me if there are any issues of concern. The shelter hearing is tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock.
Okay, so I've been asked to make some comments about what some of the research implications of some of the topics that we're talking about are. And in particular here, where we begin to think about what the needs of the kids might be in this situation and how these experiences might be affecting them, I want to turn your attention a little bit to the issues of just the stability in these kids' lives around how much they're likely to move around and continue to move around from home to home. So we have a pretty clear idea from research that we've been conducting that if kids are pretty new to the system and haven't moved around a whole lot, then their likelihood of ending up in a pretty stable placement is okay. They have a pretty decent chance. And obviously we would want to be concerned if they're struggling with that. But where we really get concerned, and fortunately this doesn't apply to these children just yet, is when kids have lots and lots of placements. So there's pretty clear evidence now that to the extent that kids have moved around as much as 5 or 6 times, they have anywhere in the neighborhood of a 10 to 20% chance only of achieving a stable permanent placement. So it's sort of like moving around begets more moving around, and that's something that we would want to be concerned about. Should be concerned about it really not just in terms of it being a general issue, but for 3 specific reasons. One, there is a lot of evidence that people doing economic analyses have found that the more kids move, the more each subsequent move costs. And in fact, it's kind of an exponential increase. So each time a kid moves, it takes more and more time for caseworkers to identify the right homes, to do the assessments necessary, and costs tend to escalate. Second, really strong connection between how much kids have moved and the extent to which they show emotional and behavioral problems. And we don't really know the direct connections here. It could be that kids with lots of problems move more, but there's at least some evidence also that moving around a lot really has a negative impact on kids and increases their emotional behavior problems. And then third, and I think this is really most current, there's an increasing amount of evidence that moving around a lot doesn't only affect behavior and emotions, but actually affects kids' brain development. So there's evidence in particular that lots of moves affect a particular area of the brain involved in something called executive functioning, which is kind of a buzzword these days. But you can think about executive functioning as like the brain's air traffic controller. It controls kind of the way in which we process information, the extent to which we're able to organize our behavior and sequence the ideas getting in, just like planes landing in an airport. So kids with lots and lots of moves are more likely to have difficulties in this area of executive functioning. And you can think about that as having implications downstream for lots of things like drug abuse problems, delinquency, problems getting along with peers and functioning in school. So I think as we begin to think about this case, since this is the first placement, I think we're in okay shape. But if we were talking about a 4th or a 5th placement for these kids, we'd really want to be paying attention to the needs in these areas.
Thank you. And as you probably all know, child welfare currently has a number of strategies that they are pursuing to reduce the number of children who are removed from home, and then if children are removed from home, to reduce the number of placements. On the next court day, the case will come before the juvenile court for a shelter hearing. The purpose of the hearing is to determine whether there was probable cause to remove the children, did the agency make reasonable or active efforts to prevent the removal, and if it is in the children's best interest to remain in care. Simultaneously, the mother has a criminal case proceeding on the drug charge. In many counties, attorneys will be available to represent the parents and children at that first hearing. In some counties, however, there are no attorneys present. This is an important hearing. There are legal issues to be decided. The parties may also have relevant information that is not known to the state. An unrepresented party who has criminal charges pending is at risk of disclosing the information that may affect the criminal case. The parents put in a very awkward position of saying nothing about the circumstances or of possibly providing incriminating information without knowing it. Judges try to prevent this, but it may also prevent parents from having any input into the decision that the court is going to have to make in terms of removal or placement of the children. Our SCID takes place in a county where attorneys are not present at this initial hearing. Among the issues that may arise at this hearing, including those that I've already mentioned, is the question of whether the case is covered by the Indian Child Welfare Act, which is a federal law and referred to as ICWA. If it is, there are a number of legal and procedural differences in the way the case will be handled. Information about how the court proceeds in cases with families covered by the Indian Child Welfare Act is included in one of the bench cards in your materials, and this card reminds judges of the important issues that arise in ICWA cases. And so event two is the shelter hearing.
We need our DA and our
good afternoon. We're here today for a shelter hearing in the matter of Justin, Jason, and Jennifer Lewis. I'm going to appoint a lawyer for Jennifer and a separate lawyer for the younger children. It has been determined that mother and father are both eligible for court-appointed counsel, and I'll appoint a lawyer to represent each of them. You will each be provided with information about how to contact your lawyer when you leave the courtroom. I'm also going to appoint a CASA, court-appointed special advocate for the children, to advocate for the best interests of each child.
After advising parents of their legal rights and the allegations of the petition that has been filed by Child Welfare, receiving a sworn statement from the worker, and hearing any information provided by Mrs. Lewis, the court finds as follows.
I've read the police report and the protective custody report, which says that law enforcement and the agency's worker went to the home yesterday and found meth in the home. The house was extremely unsanitary, and there was no edible food in the home. I've received the photos. The mother, Sally Lewis, was disoriented, and Justin, only age 2, had to be brought to the house by a neighbor. He had been wandering around the neighborhood asking for food. The mother was taken into custody and is currently lodged in jail. Jennifer, age 15, was not at home. Her whereabouts were unknown to mother. Jennifer did contact the worker when she went to mother's house last night and found the worker's contact information on the door. She told the worker she'd like to stay with friends. However, she agreed to stay in the foster home with the boys until the friend's home can be evaluated. Mr. Worker, are there legal fathers in this case, and if so, what's their status?
There is a legal father for the boys. He's in prison serving the second year of a 2-year sentence. We've not been able to contact Jennifer's father, but we believe he is also a legal father. We understand he may be living out of state.
Okay. Are there any Indian child welfare issues in this case? Do the parents have Native American heritage?
We're not sure at this time, Your Honor. The mother has named one tribe, and we will contact that tribe to determine ICWA status.
Well, based on the fact that someone has identified a possible tribal affiliation, the court will treat this as an ICWA case until it's determined not to be. Are the children placed together?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good. Are they placed with a relative?
Not at this time, but we're pursuing relative resources.
All right, I hope you will. Have the visits with mother been arranged?
They will be when she's released from jail, Your Honor. Jennifer will be permitted to visit with her mother in jail, but she has not yet decided whether or not she wants to.
Where is Jennifer today? Did you offer to bring her here to the hearing?
I did, Your Honor, but she was still in bed when I got there, and she refused to come with me.
Okay.
I would really like to have my children return to me when I get out of jail. But their grandmother came today, and I would like them to be placed with her until I get out of jail.
Mr. Worker, has grandmother been certified as a relative foster care provider?
No, Your Honor. We haven't completed the process yet to certify her, but we're working on it.
How long will that take?
We should know by tomorrow whether we're able to certify her or not.
Ms. Lewis, do you understand what this hearing is about?
I think so.
Are there other family members or close family friends who should be here today?
There's nobody that I can think of.
Well, if you think of someone, please give your worker that information about any other relatives who may be able to provide a temporary home for your children, and any family or friends who might be able to help provide transportation, support of any kind for either you or your children. Do you know how to reach Jennifer's father?
No, he hasn't been around in years, and she doesn't want any contact with him anyway.
Well, I understand that, but we're still required to contact him, so any information you have about his whereabouts will be helpful. So if you please let your attorney know if you have any of that information.
Your Honor, as for the mother, according to her criminal history, Ms. Lewis has been arrested for possession of a controlled substance, failure to appear, and DUI within the last 2 years. Ms. Lewis will be arraigned in criminal court on the current charges this afternoon. I do not expect she will be released prior to the release hearing, which is scheduled in a couple of days. The state urges the court to find probable cause to believe the conditions in the family and home reasonably appear to jeopardize the child's welfare, and temporarily commit the child to the custody of the Department of Human Services and continue them in foster care.
Thank you. As required by the Indian Child Welfare Act, I find by clear and convincing evidence that the agency has made active efforts to prevent the out-of-home placement in this case. Given that the children were in imminent danger of serious emotional or, especially in the case of the 2-year-old, physical harm, and in need of immediate care due to mother's arrest, and that the children should remain in foster care with a plan of reunification. This case will be set for a jurisdictional and dispositional hearing within 60 days. The court orders the agency to prepare a written action agreement or letter of expectation and implement the recommended visitation schedule when appropriate. I direct attorneys in CASA to contact the family as soon as possible. Mom, do you understand what's happened here today? Do you have any questions for the court?
Just about getting my kids back.
Okay. Do you know what the next steps are? Let me say, since you're in custody, you'll need to find out about release. Then you'll need to talk with your lawyer as soon as possible and discuss what steps the lawyer recommends you take.
The decisions made at this hearing are important ones. In this case, with both parents in custody, the children cannot be returned to them. Placement with a grandmother or other appropriate friend or family member known to the children is preferred once child welfare has had an opportunity to talk with them and do background checks. In order to minimize the impact of removal on children and to preserve family relationships, child welfare has adopted new rules regarding placement with relatives. The district attorney may or may not be present at this hearing depending on the county. If there is no attorney from the district attorney's office present, the DHS worker must present the case. If witnesses are called or evidence submitted at this hearing, DHS is at a significant disadvantage since caseworkers are not permitted to question witnesses, offer evidence, or make legal arguments. If necessary, the caseworker would ask the court to postpone or continue the shelter hearing until the agency can access legal advice through the Attorney General's office. The district attorney that is present does not represent the agency. You'll notice that the court appointed separate attorneys for Jennifer and her half-brothers. The court did this in order to prevent the lawyer from facing a conflict of interest between his clients. Because of the difference in age, the court is assuming that Jennifer will have strong opinions about her own case and will probably be entitled to make the decisions that are the clients to make in this kind of proceeding. The judge is also assuming that the two younger boys are similarly situated and that the lawyer for these boys will probably conclude that on most matters they are not capable of considered judgment. Under these circumstances, the lawyer will be obligated to obtain as much information as possible about them and their situation, and then the lawyer will use this information to make decisions about the direction of the case on behalf of the children. Child welfare will be required to search for the named fathers of the children and determine their legal status. If either father does not have legal status, he'll need to establish that before the end of the case if he wishes to be considered as placement for his children. Also, if there's a reasonable possibility that a child placed out of home would qualify as an Indian child under the Indian Child Welfare Act, the case is to be treated as an ICWA case until and unless ICWA is ruled out. This means that the burden of proof is clear and convincing evidence versus just a preponderance of the evidence, and there must be evidence that leaving the child at home would result in serious emotional or physical damage to the child. The next event is a team decision meeting in order to develop the case plan and determine the most appropriate placement for the children. There are several junctures in a case where a facilitated team meeting is helpful in decision-making process. A family decision meeting is a facilitated meeting with parents, extended family, community partners, service providers, attorneys for the parties, the CASA, and child welfare staff for the purpose of making child safety and placement decisions. Currently, family meetings do not occur in every district because of a lack of resources to facilitate the meetings. In those districts where they do not have family meetings, these decisions are made by the department with input from the other interested parties. And next we are on event three, which is the family decision meeting.
All right, and if we could, for the actors, if you could be around the microphones, don't worry about us seeing you. The most important part is that your voices are covered because it's going throughout the building. Some people are not hearing, and we want to make certain everything's recorded on tape. Thank you.
We have all discussed what my client needs to address, and my client agrees to participate in drug and alcohol evaluation and parenting classes. We have prepared a limited waiver of confidentiality to permit child welfare to have access to treatment information. We recommend that the children be placed with their paternal grandmother, and now that mother is out of jail, we would like to see frequent visits with the children. The boy's grandmother can supervise if the agency can't.
I haven't met my clients yet, but I do plan to visit them tonight in the foster home. I spoke with the grandmother, and she believes the children might have been exposed to meth, so they need medical evaluations.
I was able to meet with Jennifer. She's okay with the foster home at this time. She likes being with her brothers. She is attending school, and she and I will be talking about her longer-term plans in the near future.
I'm worried about my kids. I need to see them more. I know there's things that I need to work on, but I need to know that they're okay while I'm working on those things. I want them with their grandmother because they know her and they're familiar with her home.
We'll set up weekly visits at the child welfare office between you and the children. Mrs. Bridger has been approved for placement of the children, and they will be transitioning to her home. We already have medical appointments scheduled for the children. I have received a number of reports from family members about a history of significant drug use by Jennifer. I'd like to arrange for an evaluation, and we'll be discussing it further with her counsel after the meeting.
Thank you for getting them to their grandmothers. Will I get to know about the medical appointments and what the evaluations say? I'm worried about Jennifer.
Absolutely. We'll keep you updated on the children's medical information as well as school information. It may be possible for you to come with the children to medical appointments. We'll see what we can arrange.
Note that prior to this meeting, all the attorneys should have made contact with their clients and be prepared to represent their interests at the meeting. Mother's attorneys will have discussed possible courses of action mother could take and how her actions in this case could affect her criminal case. She will have discussed the pros and cons of participating in services such as drug treatment before there's been a trial or a finding that the case is appropriate for jurisdiction. Because the time frame for making decisions about how to handle the case is so limited under the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act, if the mother delays participation in treatment in the hope that the court will not find jurisdiction later at the trial, she may be jeopardizing her ability to resolve the issues that brought her children into care in time to prevent implementation of an alternative permanent plan, such as adoption or guardianship. Many drug-dependent parents choose to access treatment immediately, even if they disagree with some or all of the allegations in the petition. The attorney for the boys has not yet met with her clients. She is expected to do so promptly after her appointment, not only to begin gathering information about the children's condition upon coming into care and the appropriateness of the foster placement, but to begin developing a relationship of trust with her clients. Until recently, it was not uncommon for some lawyers to never meet with their very young clients during the whole course of their representation and to base their representation on information they've read or learned from others. The Public Defense Services Commission's contracts with providers require that attorneys see their clients within specified periods of time. A one-page discussion of the obligation of attorneys to young clients entitled The Role of Counsel is included in your materials and has been provided to all contractors who represent children. The Oregon Rules of Professional Conduct, which are binding on all lawyers, include specific provisions for representing clients with diminished capacity, such as very young children. Jennifer's lawyer is following an expressed wishes standard in representing her client. As with adult clients, Jennifer's lawyer will follow the client's direction regarding decisions which are her clients to make, such as whether she wants the court to take jurisdiction, where she wants to live, etc. She will, of course, counsel with her client about the most appropriate options available to her and how to make it more likely that the court will approve of her plan. The boy's attorney will make a determination of what he believes is in the children's best interest, since they are too young to decide and advocate for this plan. The CASA will have met with as many of the parties as possible. The CASA is considered the eyes of the court and will be advocating for the best interests of the children. Assuming a close bond between the mother and these children, weekly visits are not really sufficient. Research shows that the more frequent the visits, the greater the chance of family reunification. This is primarily a resource issue. One way of making more visits possible is to enlist the aid of family members in providing transportation or in supervising visits if supervision is required. The agency will spend the days before the jurisdiction or disposition hearing working with the mother and children and arranging their participation in services. The agency, during this period of time, will also be working with the attorneys and the CASA to develop the service plan for the case. Child welfare will make contact with the boy's father in the penitentiary to gather information about his circumstances and will also complete a foster home certification process for the grandmother. The father's attorney will be in contact with the father and will be prepared to advocate for the father's position in the case and either request to have his client transported to the hearing or arrange for him to appear by telephone or video conference. Child welfare will also try to contact Jennifer's father. He has been determined to be Jennifer's legal father, and child welfare has not yet been able to locate him or identify any additional relatives who might be resources for the children. He had recent contact a year ago with the child welfare department in Kentucky regarding a younger half-sibling, but did not provide that agency with any information about where he could be reached. Child welfare is preparing notice by newspaper publication in Oregon and Kentucky to attempt to advise the father of the pendency of this matter involving his daughter. Following this meeting, in some cases, like ours, the parent or parents actually begin services directed at addressing issues affecting their ability to provide a safe environment for their children. As soon as the children's needs are assessed, referrals are sent to possible providers, and services are begun as soon as possible for the children.
Okay, so at this point in the case, I think it may be helpful to understand the children's needs by considering research on how stress affects the developing brain. And when I talk about stress, I think it's useful to think about stress as having maybe three different levels. So the first level, you could even consider to be positive stress. Mild stress, there's plenty of evidence that suggests that it actually promotes resilience and helps to promote response to difficult circumstances and so forth. Then you can think about the second level as being tolerable stress. Tolerable stress might be difficult experiences that occur, but that people are really basically able to cope with. The third type, which is really our concern here, is what's been referred to as toxic stress. And toxic stress is really a type of stress that ultimately overwhelms the body's systems designed to help deal with stress, and therefore produces really damaging effects. And there's now a lot of evidence that exposure to toxic stress can be associated with all kinds of physical health problems like heart disease and diabetes. But there's also an increasing amount of evidence that exposure to toxic stress during childhood can produce alterations in key areas of brain development. And in particular, one of the areas that people have been documenting with increased precision is the idea that in the brain there are a lot of connections among different nerve cells, and the connections are made by branches that the nerve cells have that connect to each other. In cases of toxic stress, the number of branches in individual nerve cells is greatly reduced, and so really the amount of interconnections among different areas of the brain is similarly reduced. I think that the idea of toxic stress is one idea that's useful to keep in mind, but also I think a lot for a lot of us, our ideas about what kinds of things affect kids and child welfare has been driven by the idea that kids have been traumatized and abused, and that's certainly a problematic process. But the reality is that lots of kids are in the child welfare system, in fact the majority, not due to abuse, but due to neglect. We're now finding increasingly that neglect in and of itself can have toxic stress effects. And the reason is because if you think about babies in particular, but also young children, really development occurs in the context of parent-child relationships. And people talk about the nature of that development as like a serve and return process in tennis, where baby cries, the parent responds, the baby is soothed by the parent's response, and it's kind of this back and forth where both individuals are adjusting to each other over time. That expected kind of input that kids all have when it's absent is stressful for the individual. So when there isn't an adequate serve and return, that in and of itself can produce permanent alterations in areas of the brain. For instance, one that's been well documented has to do with the production of stress hormones that help us regulate and respond to stressors when they occur. There's plenty of evidence now that kids who've been exposed to toxic stress through neglect have different levels of stress hormones. On the positive side, we know increasingly also that the brain has a lot of plasticity to it. So even when kids have had really difficult experiences and we see changes in their brain, it's also possible to get them back on track. But it's really critical that the right kinds of supports and services are provided. What people really have a good sense of is that kids don't get back on track sort of their own accord, but really need enriched environmental circumstances to do that. And the other piece of this that I think is especially relevant in Oregon is that there are a variety of evidence-based programs, including some that have been developed here in Oregon, that have really been shown to get kids back on track, not just in terms of their behavior and emotions, but in terms of actual changes in brain development, more towards typical functioning. Ironically, a lot of these programs are being implemented on a wide-scale basis in other places like California and areas in Europe, but not really so much here in Oregon, outside of Lane County. So I think that as much as potential there is, that potential to really make changes for kids like these that we're hearing about is not always fully realized.
Thank you. The next event that you're going to hear about is the case status.
I have now been released from jail and I'm living with friends. The criminal charges have been postponed until this case is resolved. My lawyer was able to get the state to agree that if I admit to the child welfare allegations in this dependency case, I would receive probation in the criminal case. I was evicted after the arrest. My health insurance ends at the end of the month. I'm staying with a friend. I have no income, no car, and only a 10th grade education. My boys are now living with their grandmother. Jennifer was there too, but she recently ran away. She's now dropped out of school and I haven't seen her since. I visit with the boys at the child welfare office once a week, and as long as I stay clean and am participating in services, I'm also permitted to have an additional visit in the grandmother's home one time a week. I have participated in a drug and alcohol evaluation, and treatment was recommended, but there's a wait list. So I can't get into treatment right now, and I don't want to leave the county to go into another treatment program because I won't be able to visit with my children as often. My lawyer talks to me on a regular basis and is preparing for the hearing next month.
The children have had medical exams. Both boys are found to be slightly below developmental norms for their ages, but the prognosis for both of them is good. Jason continues in Head Start, and his grandmother is providing transportation. We are working closely with DHS and the boys' lawyer to make sure that both children's needs are being met. Jennifer was supposed to start adolescent drug treatment program, but she ran away from the grandmother's home. Family members think she's living on the street and occasionally staying with her friends. Child Welfare is exploring residential treatment options for Jennifer, if and when she's found.
We've developed a service plan for Ms. Lewis, and she is participating in services. We have met and outlined the conditions for return, and these are the safety issues which she must deal with before the children return to her home. It's not required that all the needed services be completed before the children are returned home, but we must be able to resolve the safety issues before return. Once that happens, we will continue to work with the mother to complete the rest of her services so jurisdiction can be dismissed and the case closed. It's not required that the parent complete all of the services before the children return home, but there does need to be significant progress made that the children would be safe in the home environment. Finally, we have begun conversation with the mother about the concurrent plan. The plan for the children, if they can't return home because she has not been able to address the issues that brought them into care.
We'll now see the jurisdiction and dispositional hearing. The jurisdiction hearing is also called an adjudicatory hearing, and it's the trial on the case. The purpose of the jurisdiction hearing is for the court to determine whether or not the allegations are true. The state is required to present evidence to prove the allegations, and all parties have the right to call witnesses, present evidence, as well as question any witnesses who testify. If after hearing the evidence, the court finds that the allegations are true, then there will be a dispositional hearing, usually immediately after the evidence is presented and the court has found the allegations to be true. The purpose of the dispositional hearing is for the court to review the case plan, determine what the parents need to do in order for the children to be returned home, and the case to be dismissed, and address any other needs of the parents and the children.
We're here today for the adjudicatory hearing in the case. Let the record reflect father for the boys is on the phone from the penitentiary.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. We have confirmed that this case is not subject to the Indian Child Welfare Act.
Step up to the mic, would you please?
Sorry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Both parents before the court are prepared to resolve the matter without a trial. During the pretrial conference, the mother's attorney, Ms. Lewis, and I discussed the allegations in the petition, and it's my understanding the mother does not want to contest the petition. She does not want a trial where the state would be required to prove by a preponderance of evidence that the allegations in the petition are true. Instead, she intends to admit to allegation 2A as pled. She will admit she has an alcohol and substance abuse problem, which impairs her ability to provide adequate care to the children and creates a substantial risk of harm. I have also discussed the matter with the attorney for the boy's father, and it is my understanding he will admit that he is currently incarcerated and that he needs drug treatment upon his release from custody in order to be able to provide adequate care for his children. Judge Jennifer's father has not yet been located. We are attempting to get service by publication on him and would ask to postpone for further proceedings with regard to that individual until service is made.
Your Honor, we're prepared to admit to allegation 2A of the petition.
Okay. Have you advised your client of the right she gives up by admitting to the petition and the legal consequences of that?
I have, Your Honor.
All right. Ms. Lewis. Do you understand the rights that you give up by
admitting these things, and do you understand the legal consequences of admitting allegation 2A of the petition that I see you have before you there?
Yes.
Ms. Lewis, then, do you admit that the children's condition or circumstances are such as to endanger their welfare due to the fact that you have an alcohol or substance abuse problem which impairs your ability to provide adequate care to the children and creates a substantial risk of harm to them?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel for Father, is your client willing to admit to the allegations, and have you advised him of his rights?
Yes, Your Honor, and we are prepared to admit the petition.
Okay. Mr. Jones, can you hear me okay? Good. Do you understand the rights you're giving up by admitting the allegations of the petition and the legal consequences of doing that?
Father is on the phone, and he has acknowledged that he does.
Mr. Jones, then, do you admit that your children's condition or circumstances are such as to endanger their welfare due to the fact that you're currently incarcerated, that you need drug treatment upon your release from custody in order to be able to provide adequate care to them?
Father made the admission.
Is the state in agreement?
The state is in agreement, Your Honor.
And is CASA in agreement?
Yes, I am.
Good. Now, I've received a case plan and a court report from Child Welfare. I've received a CASA report and letters of support from Mother's attorney. I'd like to mark and receive these into evidence unless there's an objection. Anybody object? Okay.
There having been no objection, the court has admitted the exhibits and has reviewed them.
Mr. Worker, what's the current status of the case and what is the concurrent plan?
Your Honor, the mother has completed a drug and alcohol evaluation. Outpatient treatment was recommended. Child Welfare has moved the children to their paternal grandmother's home. She's been certified for relative placement. The mother has been referred for services. There's a wait list for a drug and alcohol treatment service. So for now, the mother is participating in random UAs and attending Narcotics Anonymous meetings. Visitation through the agency continues, and mother is also having one visit a week at the grandmother's home as long as she is not using. We sent a letter to the boy's father regarding some of the treatment that is available in prison. The plan is to return the children to the mother if she evidences an ability to parent them. The concurrent plan is adoption by the grandmother.
Your Honor, Justin, the two-year-old, has been having some behavioral difficulties at home. I recommend that Child Welfare arrange an assessment to determine whether he needs early intervention services. Some of his difficulties may be related to the separation from his mother. The current visitation schedule is insufficient, and we would also ask that Child Welfare make appropriate efforts to find resources to increase that contact.
So my comment here is just about the importance of the assessment in this case. You know, the child, Justin, has started to have behavioral problems, and there's concerns about needing to address those. But the attorney makes a comment that, you know, may be related to separation from the mother. And the reality is that based on the information we have available to us right now, we don't really have a clear idea of whether that's the case or not. It may be the case that it's due to problems in terms of separation from mom. It could be that grandma just needs some additional support and parenting skills. It could be that Justin, given mom's substance abuse history, is beginning to show some of the signs of prenatal drug and alcohol exposure and is really going to need more substantive intervention because we're talking about more neurodevelopmental difficulties. And this is where really good quality assessment can help in aiding the decision making rather than just sort of saying, well, we're swayed, we think it's attachment, so let's increase the visits with mom, which in some instances may either do no good or might even make things worse. So I just want to underscore the importance of assessments here.
Your Honor, I have met with Jason and Justin in their grandmother's home. They appear to be nicely settled in and actually flourishing in that home. I believe that the children should remain in her care and DHS continue to offer services to the mother until the children can be returned to her safely. I have not been able to meet with Jennifer since she ran away.
Okay. I see that grandmother's here. I'd like to hear from you.
Yes, Your Honor. The children are doing really well. They transitioned well from the foster parents' home. And the foster parents are really good people, and they've even offered to provide some care on the weekends to give me a break if I need that.
Excellent. And what about Jennifer? What's Jennifer's situation?
Your Honor, we were able to do a partial screening that could not be completed until Jennifer is able to participate, but we are looking at possible residential treatment options. Her school records are included in the materials, and they disclose a long history of absence. When we locate Jennifer, we also need to address her educational needs, as well as a suspected drug use and a possible history of physical abuse by her father. These were all issues that were identified in the materials.
Thank you very much. The court is prepared to proceed to disposition on all three children today. Although jurisdiction has not yet been established as to Jennifer's father, we will set that over as requested by the district attorney in time to so that service by publication can be accomplished if necessary. The court finds the children to be within the jurisdiction of the court and orders that the children be made wards of the court with continued custody to child welfare. The court finds that child welfare has made reasonable efforts to make it possible for the children to return home and that it is in the children's best interest to continue an out-of-home placement. The court orders the agency to develop an action agreement with the boy's father addressing services he may access in prison and appropriate contact with the children, and to continue to seek service on Jennifer's father. The court today approves the primary plan of return to mother with the concurrent plan of adoption. Child welfare is to continue the services as outlined in the action agreement and to evaluate whether additional visits can be supervised by grandmother if the mother remains clean and sober. The court also orders DHS to explain the adoption process to grandmother and begin to work on the concurrent plan should the primary plan not be achieved. As required by law, I will also set the permanency hearing in this case 1 year from today, and the Citizen Review Board will review the case in 4 months from this date.
It's important to note here that some parents choose to have a trial where the state would have to call witnesses and prove the allegations of the petition. If there is a trial, there's no jury. The court decides whether the allegations are true. The rules of evidence do apply. Parties can call witnesses and can cross-examine and submit evidence. The trial is required to be held within 60 days of the children being removed from a parent unless the court finds good cause to set it later. We're now 6 months into the case, and we will see the Citizen Review Board doing their hearing.
Good afternoon. We're here today to review Justin, Jennifer, and Jason's case plan. We're volunteers that have been appointed by the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court to review cases of children who are in out-of-home care. We do this impartially. We are required to make findings that address the efforts made by DHS, that the parents are progressing on what the required services that they're being asked to do, and that the safety and well-being needs of the child are being met. We do this by reviewing the material that we receive from DHS, any psychological evaluations, notes from providers in the case. We hear from all the parties that are here in the room, and we make our findings and recommendations based upon that. The children have been in foster care for 6 months. The boys are residing with their grandmother. Jennifer was residing with her grandmother, but we have learned today that she is currently at a girls' ranch where she's receiving drug treatment.
Parents, attorneys, CASAs, caseworkers, foster parents, service providers, relatives, and foster children age 14 and older are invited to participate in CRB reviews. Each participant attending the review provides the board with information on the status of the case and informs the board if they have suggested recommendations in the case. The board will then make written recommendations and findings.
A copy of our findings and recommendations will be sent to the court, DHS, and all relevant parties. I want to thank you all for being here today. Your input is greatly appreciated.
The Citizen Review Board reviews all cases of children in foster care. The reviews occur every 6 months unless the court itself has reviewed the case and waived the CRB review. The purpose of the CRB is to ensure that there are appropriate plans in place for children and that the plans are consistently monitored by an objective group of lay citizens. CRB members are community volunteers who've undergone special training in these types of cases. In this case, the court found that the board found, excuse me, the plan to be appropriate, but made some recommendations for services, including exploration of treatment services in which the children could be placed with the mother. The board also recommended that the agency work to develop an action agreement with the father of the boys to address the long-range plans for the children. Another CRB will be held in 6 months after the first. This review is an opportunity to make final recommendations as to the permanency plan for the children prior to the permanency hearing, which will be held by the court. The permanency hearing must be held within 12 months after a child is found to be within the jurisdiction of the court, or 14 months after the child was placed in substitute care, whichever is the earlier date, unless the court has excused reasonable efforts to reunify the children with the parent due to aggravated circumstances, in which case the permanency hearing must be held within 30 days of the court finding of aggravated circumstances. The next event that you are going to see is the permanency hearing.
Now is the time for the permanency hearing for Justin, Jason, and Jennifer. The law requires that the permanency hearing be held in their cases at this time because they're still in substitute care and they've been within the court's jurisdiction within the last 12 months. So the threshold questions that the court has to decide today is whether the parents have made sufficient progress to permit the children to be safely returned to their care, and whether DHS has made reasonable efforts to make the children's safe return home possible. If the agency's reunification efforts are reasonable, but the parents have not made sufficient progress to permit the children's safe return home, I must decide whether the plan is to reunify the family or whether I should change the case plan today to adoption or some other permanent plan like guardianship. I've received a case plan and court report from Child Welfare, a CASA report, psychological reports for mother and the boy's father and the children, report from treatment providers, and letters of support from mother's attorney. Counsel, is there any objection to these being marked and received as exhibits?
And since there was no objection, the court has reviewed the exhibits.
Mr. Worker, what is the agency's plan for the children as of today?
Your Honor, we plan to continue offering services to the mother until she can have her children returned to her care, and we anticipate that will take place in 60 days. She did have 3 months of clean UAs with one relapse. Now she realizes she needs to continue in her treatment, and she will be entering an inpatient program next week. Jennifer was charged with a felony drug offense while on the run from the girls' ranch. A delinquency petition has been filed, and when Jennifer is located, we will ask that she be held at a detention center while we attempt to locate another placement. It may well be the case that the Oregon Youth Authority is in a better position than the Child Welfare to care for this young woman. Jennifer's father has still not been located, and he hasn't responded to our attempts to contact him.
Your Honor, we agree with the plan for the boys. Mother made sufficient progress in her initial treatment, but as the court is aware, relapse is not uncommon in the treatment process. In order to have the best chance of success, Mother is willing to engage in an inpatient program. She has been evaluated and found eligible for this level of treatment and is on a waiting list for a program that permits children to reside with the parent after an established period of sobriety. There are services available to the children in this program that will help them deal with their separation issues.
Your Honor, my client has been released from prison. He's not present today, but I'm able to represent to the court that he supports permanent placement with his mother, the boy's grandmother, with whom they've been living for most of the past year.
Your Honor, while Justin, the 2-year-old, has expressed a very strong desire to be returned to his mother, in view of his age and lack of maturity, I'm representing both children's best interests here today, and I cannot agree with the continuation of the plan to return the child to mother. She has a long history of drug use, even though this is her first encounter with the justice system. Now she's relapsed, and the program she's entering is a 12-month program. We won't know for much of that time what her prospects will be for long-term success. The children have adjusted well to their grandmother's home, and while ongoing contact with their mother will be important, they need stability and permanency now. We do believe, however, that guardianship, rather than adoption, is the most appropriate plan for the children, and I understand that to be the grandmother's preference as well.
Your Honor, I cannot fully agree with the boy's attorney. The children waited long enough for a permanent home. I believe that the plan should be changed to adoption by the grandmother. The children are doing very well in that home and need the continued stability that the grandmother can offer. The mother has had at least one dirty UA in the past 3 months and is facing a probation violation hearing, which I believe may be the real reason for her recent interest in inpatient treatment.
Your Honor, of course I'm willing to care for my grandchildren, but I believe that mother should be given a chance now that she's ready to start treatment. The children really love her and miss her a lot.
Your Honor, this isn't the time to go into details about a plan for Jennifer. When she's located, it will certainly be my position that although there is a delinquency proceeding pending, her needs would be much more appropriately addressed in this dependency proceeding. As the court is aware, she made a certain amount of progress in treatment and is struggling with issues related primarily to the neglect and abuse she experienced as a child.
Before we hear what the judge decides on what the permanent plan should be, as you can tell, there are a lot of issues that have to be considered. Getting clean and sober for long-time users is a difficult task. It takes time, and the timelines are short in our cases. In addition, once a person is clean and sober, it's not unusual for other issues to begin to really come to the surface. People have sometimes been self-medicating, and there are mental health issues, family of origin issues, emotional conditions, lack of education, employment, housing, transportation, and other major challenges that have to be addressed. Adolescents can require very different services than young children. Jennifer is 16 now and still very unsettled. Although she's been found in possession of drugs, is the delinquency system the appropriate place to deal with her issues? Are there alternatives available through child welfare, particularly if she refuses to stay in a non-secure placement? She'll be in need of independent living skills to help her as she gets ready for being on her own in the near future. Child welfare, her attorney, the CASA, all need to be involved in helping her to take advantage of the services and support that is available to her.
So, co-chairs, members of the committee, you can see that everyone's been reading from a script up to this point, but the script is now blank. So, if you want to know from me what I might do, I'll tell you, but I would like to first pose the question to you. Anyone have a sense of what you might do? We've had conflicting recommendations from the agency, from the boy's attorney, and from the CASA. The plan could go either way at this point. Either extend, allow mother to go to inpatient treatment, continuing the plan to return to her care, or today, change the plan to adoption with a grandmother, or the less permanent plan of guardianship by the grandmother. So three choices, not perhaps a clear path. Anybody want to weigh in? Especially anyone getting CLE credit. I don't know.
I'm not a lawyer.
Okay.
Representative Smith over there looks like he has a suggestion.
I'm all good. I'm actually looking forward to hear your wisdom, Mr. Chair. Topic.
Well, it would seem to me that in the decision that you have as the maker here, as the decision maker, you have a lot of information. Of course, we know that you've reviewed it and taken things in consideration. With the best interest of the child being the focal point, it would seem that the balancing you would find yourself doing is which way do you think is going to give the best, and at the same time trying to, let's say, accommodate the needs of those others that have interest in those three children. And I guess from what I know, the limited part, I would say either the continuation to go forward to allow the mother to go through the treatment. The guardianship would be another one that would give you that opportunity. It sounded like the grandmother did not want to have outright adoption. And that, I think that would be something that you would weigh as a reason why you may not want to go there.
Thank you, Senator, for your courage and your comments. Well, briefly, obviously, mother's the only option since dad's in prison, and we can't yet, we're probably just publishing on the teenager's dad. And with respect to the teenager, we don't know what to do yet and won't know until she's before us so we can talk to her directly and really come up with a plan. As to mother, the question is, has she made sufficient progress? Obviously, no. Will she make it within a reasonable time? And that's where the nature of the inpatient treatment program would make a difference to me. The fact that the one she's on the waiting list for also takes the kids makes the time shorter because she doesn't have to be perfect by the time we give her back her kids because she's under the supervision of an inpatient treatment program. So that would weigh heavily on my decision. If she was just on a waiting list for a program that she'd be off for 12 months and then we'd see how she'd do after that, that starts to be getting to be a really long time, especially since for a now 3-year-old and 6-year-old, you know, the 10 days from now to Christmas is a really long time. So we're taught to look at time through the eyes of the child. The fact that the kind of treatment program means we could reunify quicker makes me lean towards giving her that chance. So even though, as CASA points out, her motives may be suspect given the probation violation coming up, the nature of addiction is such that relapse is part of the disease. She is more motivated now than she ever has been. And the court has other information in her psychological and some other reports that suggest to me that the removal of her children has been a defining moment for her. And she may really be finally in that stage of change where she's going to take this seriously and turn herself around. And I've seen the worst kind of meth addicts actually turn themselves around. So I'd be inclined to give the 60 days and see where she is then. With respect to how this plays into the best interests of the children, I think it's important to note, too, that I am hypothetically assuming I got other information that suggests that these little boys have a very strong attachment to this mother. And therefore, it's important to give the mother another chance to prove that reunification is the plan. At 60 days, if I find that she was just phoning it in, and hasn't really made a commitment to her sobriety, I would probably pull the plug at that point because of the ages of the kids. It's really important that we establish permanency. With respect to the choice between guardianship and adoption, I've changed my thinking about this over the years, but surprisingly perhaps to you, I would probably go with adoption. You heard Dr. Fisher talk about attachment, and I think it's important for the grandmother to really step up and be the primary attachment figure. And sometimes when we do guardianship, it's sort of like, well, I'm not really the mom, I'm just the grandma. I think I would go with adoption. And the model I have for this is open adoption. The bio mom could play the role that a bio parent does in an open adoption case, where the adoptive parents are the parents. But the child also knows that, oh, I have this bio mom too. So I would go with adoption. The other reason for it is I sense that grandma is perhaps a good enabler, at least as played by Judge Orff. she might be willing to, if she was just the guardian, and not where the person with whom the buck stops, I get a sense that she might waffle a little and give mom some latitude that isn't appropriate. And if she were the adoptive parent, she wouldn't do that. So I think that's where I'd come down. But anyway, thank you very much for your time, and I hope that you got something out of this. I think, Judge Waller, is it time for questions?
If you have any questions, we would be very willing to try to answer them for you.
So we're open up for questions now, and before we start there, I do want to acknowledge Ingrid Swenson, who's in the room and have seen the script here, the director.
She's our director.
Thank you very much for putting this all together and all those others that have questions from anyone up here that on the panel. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask the judges if there's anything that you can do to help facilitate treatment for or programs, like Dr. Fisher mentioned, to help rebuild the kids so that we don't end up with like another generation of people in the situation of the mother. So both with the daughter and with the two boys, what can you do to help make sure that they get what they need to to get out of the cycle that they're in?
We certainly want to make sure that they get the assessments that are a high quality assessment so that we're really sure of what the issues are. And then luckily there are programs, knock on wood, there will continue to be, that provide the kind of work that Dr. Fisher was talking about. We know that getting kids into early, high quality early head start can ameliorate a lot of the stress that he was talking about that they have been affected by. So there are, you know, we require that there be plans for the children in addition to plans for the parents. And I think we're getting much more sophisticated, especially about little children, of recognizing it's not just that we put them in a bubble and wait until the parent is ready, but that we really need to begin to address what their needs are and what stress they have been subjected to during their short lives.
Senator Bonamici, the good news in Oregon is that the Oregon Health Plan, at least today, currently pays if there's a demonstrated diagnosis of a separation or attachment issue, would pay for an evidence-based practice called parent-child interaction therapy. So if those boys were placed with grandma, they could be in that and work on the robustness of the relationship between them and grandma. Also, once they return to mom, they could. It's a dyadic therapy, meaning the caregiver and the child are in it together, and so that will help them. I don't. Maybe Dr. Fisher wants to comment on other modalities that might be available that we can afford.
Well, I'll be brief. I do think there are a variety of approaches, and one of the most promising is just the idea of therapeutic foster care, which is that rather than supplemental services, that the foster home is seen as a therapeutic environment, and that's where some of the supports that I was talking about can be put in place to help the foster parents, whether it's grandma or a non-relative foster parent, provide some of these basic services to help with those serve and return processes I was talking about. But I also would say, you know, this is a perfect example of where partnership between the judicial system, what academic researchers like myself do, and state legislatures can really bring to bear in terms of making these kinds of programs more readily available in community settings. I think that's one of the big challenges, and obviously with the economic situation, it's an even bigger challenge. But I think state legislatures play as big a role as any other entity in terms of making these kinds of services more readily available to families.
All right, Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question I think for this panel too is, assume hypothetically we had a little bit of extra money freed up. It's obviously a hypothetical question. not a lot of money, but if we had a little bit, where in this whole system could we put that money and get the best return on each dollar?
There are counties, and in the skit that we did, this was a county where there were not lawyers available at the time of the initial shelter hearing. And any judge who does juvenile work will tell you that what happens at the initial shelter hearing is very, very important. It's important to have representation from the very beginning. There's research done out of the state of Washington that good representation leads to a reduction of time in care. And so for a little bit of money, we could get lawyers available at shelter hearings in every jurisdiction in the state, and I think that would be an enormous step forward. And in my county, we have the wonderful good fortune of having lawyers available at the shelter hearing. It makes a tremendous difference in that important decision about whether or not we are going to remove a child or whether or not a safety plan can be put together to leave a child at home. And since we are trying to safely and equitably reduce the number of children in foster care in Oregon, that's an incredibly important decision.
Other questions? Senator Wissett.
Thank you. Generally, some comments. I think, generally speaking, you people do wonderful work. I think there are some places that, within the skit, that from my experience, things could be improved. The home worker, the caseworker, to my knowledge, there's virtually no requirement for education, training, or experience in these workers, and yet they hold a tremendous amount of power. When you talk about the substantiated charges, the courts, I believe, deal nicely with those. But what is considered a founded charge by Department of Human Services, is my understanding that that's a preponderance of evidence, and that essentially even if the court finds the parent or whoever not guilty of any charges, or even if they decline to prosecute, still the founded charge remains and there's no way to get rid of it. It just hangs there. I think that's another major problem. One of the things that we hear from our constituents fairly frequently is that, particularly foster parents, is that they're really not told all of the background of the children that they are asked to take care of, because some of the background is confidential. And some of that puts, sometimes that puts the foster parent at great disadvantage. The attorneys appointed for the children and the parents, I believe certainly in small towns or small areas, are too often all employees of the same contract agency. And it's very difficult, I think, for those people to keep, to really separate their actions, because they're all really working in the same law firm. And then finally, when you read the statutes, the members of the CRB and CASA have great power, but in the communities, it really isn't realized. I mean, CASAs are often denied access to all sorts of records that statutorily they're allowed to access to, and the CRB is in certainly in some of the counties that I represent are uniformly ignored by DHS.
If I can just say, co-chairs and Senator Whitsitt, you've adequately you've described the fact that this is a little like conducting a symphony, and some of the instruments can be out of tune and not to play well together, therefore. So it's always a challenge.
Other comments? Representative Stigler?
No.
Well, I want to say thank you for your participation in the work group. Unfortunately, Representative Krieger stepped out of the room, and also to him. If there's no other questions or comments, I want to thank you all very, very much for coming forward and giving us this presentation. For all our actors, I know you're taking time out of your professional day to give us the insight of what many of you deal with on a day-to-day basis, and we want to thank you for that time and for your service.
Mr. Chair, I just would add that it's a rarity in the area of child welfare, quite frankly, to have a group such as this where you have the some oftentimes disparate factions who come together and try to come to solutions and resolutions of issues that sort of plague the entire system. So I've been very impressed with the work that the group has done, and with the vibrant discussions that have often occurred in those meetings. And I think that's how good policy is arrived at, and changes that are necessary are made in a system such as this.
Again, thank you very, very much for being part of the hearing today and giving us your perspective to give us more knowledge for when we deal with these issues during the session.
Thank you all.
And thank you for being simple. Us not lawyers.
All right, one of the things we're going to do is we're still in our informational hearings, but what we are going to do is we're going to accelerate the very last item that we have is the introduction of bills for both the House and the Senate. The reason for that is, as you can see, we have members that are coming and going, and we're concerned as we get later in the afternoon, their duties may force them out, and we want to make certain we get to that point. So as soon as we allow our participants from the first informational hearing to clear, we'll take a quick recess on the informational meeting and go into our work sessions.
Okay, and before we do that, Mr. Co-Chair, I'd like to introduce a member-elect we have that's with us today, Representative-elect Matt Wand is on my right, your left. He's the new representative from Gresham, and we invite him to come today. He is an attorney with the Wand Law Firm in Gresham, and we welcome you. Thank you for showing up today.
Thank you very much for being here. We look forward to working with you
in the session. All right, with that, I'm going to take do a recess on the informational hearing on the Senate side, and the House will be doing, I think, a recess on their side. And with that, we'll open up a work session on the Senate side.
Work session on the House side.
And at this point, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask for Staff Attorney Cheyenne Ross to please read the LCs that are going to be considered for adoption as committee bills on the Senate side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Pending introduction on the Senate side are LCs 107, 161, 165, 166, 167, 174, 175, 176, 177, 179, 181, 192, 193, 194, 195, 196, 198, 216, 218, 255, 256, 301, 302, 304, 306, 307, 366, 461, 462, 463, 465, 466, 467, 471, 472, 473, 882, 883, 886, 889, 933, 968, 968-1, 969, 1030, 1045, 1056, 1061, 1062, 1124, 1125, 1126, 1169, 1247, 1288, 1687, 1927, 1946, 1963, 2180, 2197, 2244, 2251, 2457, 2495, 2562, 2552, 2718, 2733, 2759, 2769, 2782, 2783, 2799, 2825, 2832, 2833, 2834, 2835, 2836, 2838, 2919, and 3030.
All right. So one thing we want to put on the record, what we are going through at this point is basically a process that allows for various committee or legislative concepts to move forward in our process for the next session. The numbers that we have just read, all of those and the actual text of those LCs will be posted. I believe they're not posted at this moment. They will be posted by the end of our meeting today, and people will be able to access those to see what the concepts include. One of the other caveats is that anyone that is voting today to introduce the measures does not mean that they will be supporting the measures when they actually come before the committees, if they even come before the committees for consideration for passage out of a committee. This is just a process, and we have actually been traditionally the, the safety net for many committees and many agencies and individuals to get bills into the process. And that's why on our side, I believe we have over 80 that are coming in on the Senate side, and a similar number or close to it on the House side. And again, the vote that you will be hearing now is one to just move the bills forward. Does not mean that each and every member will agree in the future to their moving forward in the process once they are considered at the at a committee level. With that,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the LCs read by staff previously be introduced as committee bills, and then I'll speak to my motion, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Boquist moves that we adopt, and as read by staff attorney, counsel Shannon Ross, the LCs that were introduced. And one thing I want to make certain people understand, the script that we're working off of does have dated numbers as to when those drafts were done. We are not including that in the motion, and the reason for that is because some of these LCs may have been updated from the time that they were actually given to us. And so what we are adopting, or what is to be moved on the Senate side, is just the introduction of the LC, understanding the most recent version that is in front of council and the committee is what will be actually introduced to the Secretary of the Senate. Any discussion? Senator Boquist.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. As the Vice Chair, I just want to reiterate what the Chair did say. I'm quite certain I would agree with some of these bills. I'm quite certain I would vote against some of these bills, even though I haven't read them. And I would simply ask the Chair, when the time comes, to give a due process from both the minority and the majority point of view. And with that, Mr. Chair, I don't have any problem with them becoming legislative committee bills.
All right. Senators, any other discussion?
Okay.
Any objection to the motion that's before us? Not seeing or hearing any, so adopt it. And those LCs that have been read into the record by
Ms. Ross has are in fact LCs that will be introduced as committee bills from the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary.
House Judiciary Committee asked Ms. Ross to read the LC, or Bill Taylor.
Sir, members of the committee, you have LC 91, 162, 163, 164, 169, 170, 172, 173, 178, 180, 198, 300, 303, 303-1 and 303-2, 425, 443, 444, 445, 446, 464, 468, 469, 470, 474, 475, 476, 477, 594, 884, 888. $1,031, $1,032, $1,033, $1,162, $1,170, $1,245, $1,473, $1,476, $1,540, $1,621, $1,750, $1,752, $1,753, $1,754, $2,025, $2,194, $2,534, $2,269, LC 364, LC 1168, and then 1168-1.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move that the LCs just read by Mr. Taylor be introduced as committee bills.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Stigler moves that the previous bills listed LCs be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? No further discussion. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And in the because of the length of the agenda, I will ask and put on the record that the same thing that Senator Polzanski just went through would apply to these as well. And I will close the work session and open the return to the public hearing.
And the city Senate will reopen our its informational meeting at this time. And the next thing we have on our agenda is Max Williams, who's going to be giving us a presentation on evidence-based practices in guards of SB 267. Director, thank you for being here.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to return and be in front of you this afternoon. In the interest of time, I know you have a very deep agenda and busy schedule. Mr. Taylor asked that I come and prepare some and provide some brief remarks about Senate Bill 267 and sort of where we stand today as a state with respect to evidence-based practices and programs and how that's being implemented in the agencies. As sort of an introductory statement, each of the five agencies that was subject to the 2003 legislation submitted in September their report as required by the legislation to the committee. So you should have already the five agency reports with respect to their biennial implementation of Senate Bill 267 before you. And instead of having each of those five agencies come up and speak individually, we thought it might be an appropriate time to provide just a brief overview or reminder of what Senate Bill 267 was designed to accomplish, sort of where we're at and where we think we're going with respect to the legislation. You'll recall that Senate Bill 267 passed in 2003, came out of a period of time that felt a little bit like the period that you're in right now, albeit not nearly as extreme. And some of you are around at that time. We thought the sky was falling then, and now I think we would look back and refer to that as a warm summer rain in comparison to the experience that you're all and we are all collectively confronting. But one of the challenges we had at that time is we were being asked to make a lot of determinations about where we were going to invest very limited resources or where we were going to make reductions of considerable resources as it related to programming primarily designed around the idea of reducing recidivism and trying to drop the reoffense rate. And there weren't very good approaches to do that. And Senate Bill 267, co-authored by myself at that time and Representative Rob Patridge, who chaired the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways
Ways and Means, was really designed as a way to try to force those agencies involved in delivering programming services with respect to reducing the reoffense rate and changing behavior to start to use programs that were in fact evidence-based. So the legislation was written. There was a lot of challenges during that period of time as to what that might actually mean and what might be accomplished by it, and by and large fairly well embraced by the agencies. Little did I know at the time that we finally passed the legislation that a year later I'd be trying to implement it at the Department of Corrections. The good news, I think, about Senate Bill 267, if there's, and it's still quite, we were at a conference earlier, some of us earlier this week or late last week, in Multnomah County, and some of the national people pointed out that Oregon still remains not only the first, but I think maybe still the only or one of the only states that actually has legislation associated with requiring an evidence-based programming piece by the legislature tied to an agency's budget. And so you recall how the legislation worked. 25% in the first biennium of those programs had to be dedicated to evidence-based programs, 50% by the second biennium, and then 75% was the maximum amount by the third biennium. So we're at a time now where all the agencies should be at 75%. And for my agency at the Department of Corrections, that doesn't just mean the programs that we offer during the period of incarceration. It also means the programs that community corrections are implementing in the field. So it's all 36 counties. And I think if there is one thing that the bill has done is that it more quickly advanced the state's movement towards evidence-based programs among all of the agencies and among all of the field providers. The people who we contract with typically to provide alcohol and drug treatment or cognitive behavior restructuring. And I think that's true for the other agencies as well, if you would talk to them. Many of us have incorporated the requirements for Senate Bill 267 and the implementation of evidence-based programs in our contracts. So as we contract now with these providers, this is a contract requirement to which we get to hold them accountable. And for, I think, all of the agencies, we have developed fidelity models to not just say that once a program has been blessed, you can kind of pass on it, you never have to go back and look, but in fact it requires that we go back with fairly consistent regularity and reevaluate those programs to determine that they're being delivered the way they need to be delivered. You can get an evidence-based program, but if it's being delivered poorly, you're not going to get the results that the evidence would suggest you would. And so that fidelity process of going back and evaluating that program. In corrections, in the Youth Authority, we use something, and with community corrections, called the CPC, the Corrections Program Checklist, and that's the instrument that we use to go back and evaluate programs. And programs that score in needs improvement or failing are either then put on a plan to improve, working with those contractors, or in some cases the programs are eliminated as an ineffective approach and the resources are diverted to something more effective. And certainly we did that inside the Department of Corrections early on when we found several of our programs were designed so poorly that they would not produce the results that we were intending to achieve with them. And that, by and large, was what the measure was intended to accomplish. Beyond just that issue, there was a second piece of the component, not only that the program be evidence-based, but that it also be cost-effective. And I would tell you that over the 7 years that we've struggled around this issue, the tougher nut to cut was the cost-effectiveness issue. That was the hard deal. Because cost-effectiveness is a very difficult thing, depending on what you're counting as your inputs, your outputs, and a uniform approach to measurement. I can tell you that even 5 years ago, when I gave a speech to a national group that was in Portland meeting on this issue, we still hadn't made the kind of progress we wanted to make with regards to cost-effectiveness. But if you happen to be at the What Works conference on Friday that was sponsored by Multnomah County, you saw the Criminal Justice Commission preview a cost-effectiveness tool that they've been working on in conjunction with the Washington Public Policy Institute and with some funding from the Pew folks to actually, I think, develop the first comprehensive cost-effectiveness tool that would be available for policymakers like yourselves to really understand when you make a policy decision around criminal justice issues and a reinvestment of those resources into programming that's designed to reduce recidivism and offense rates, that you can see the impact it has not only on what it will do to the crime rate issues, but what it will do to actually your investment in the resource and whether or not it produces some sort of a dividend, either to reinvest back into a justice-related program or into some other investment in your general fund budget, whether it be education, human services, or something else. It's the best effort I think we've made so far on trying to address cost-effectiveness that allows you to use a tool that works across the system, and I'm really quite encouraged that we've made the progress as a state that we've made to try to address those issues. I have a lot of additional detail about Senate Bill 267, and I'd be happy to have the remarks that I prepared distributed to you individually for your reading. I think it's fair to say, and I want to make this really, really clear to everyone, 267, I don't believe, was a panacea. It hasn't completely revolutionized the world or necessarily solved all our problems. But what I think it has done, and what we can say that it's done, is it put Oregon on a faster and firmer footing, certainly at the agency level, as we look at and evaluate programs and spend state resources that are designed to try to change people's behavior and break the cycle of crime and recidivism. It put us on a much faster footing towards adopting those approaches as a state. And I think it's it remains an effective tool. And I'd encourage you, as you go about your business, certainly in this next biennium with the difficulties that we're going to be facing, to consider asking the kinds of questions that you might want to ask about the kind of program issues as you make the difficult choices that you're going to make. We have a number of, I think, tough choices in front of us, and I think there is the ability now to sort of anticipate what the long-term impacts would be if we decide, for example, to eliminate Representative Tomei and I serve on the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. We know what the investment of prevention dollars, for example, to try to lower our long-term impacts on teen drinking, for example, can do to the state, and we've got tools now that can actually help us project what those savings will be, not only just in sort of the 20 years from now kind of a thing, but in a much more immediate framework. And I'd encourage you to consider using those tools as you move forward through the challenges that you've got in front of you. So without boring you with any more details, knowing the length of your agenda, I'll conclude my remarks and just simply respond to any questions you might have about Senate Bill 267 or its implementations.
All right, questions? Oh, come on. Representative Smith. Representative Olson, you're next.
Thanks, Max. Really, really valuable. Any other areas in, you know, and you served here, obviously, any other areas where evidence-based decision-making could inform sort of our lawmaking, not only around sentencing, but around sort of the public safety sector in general? And then my follow-up question is, what's the best source to look for that kind of stuff?
Well, I think there are a number of national organizations, and almost, I would say, that if you'll remember the five agencies that are impacted by this, it was the Department of Corrections, the Youth Authority, Addictions and Mental Health Division of DHS, the Criminal Justice Commission, and then the Children and Families Commission. All five of those agencies were subject to Senate Bill 267, and I'm sure all five of them have given you their reports for September. In each one of them, I think you would find a different body of potential research that's out there that's helping drive decision-making. And it isn't just evidence-based with respect to sentencing. It's also just the implementation of the program expenditures that we have as we try to reduce recidivism. I would tell you, beyond even public safety, and we all know this, most of this evidence-based process really got started from the medical side of the equation. It was using sort of evidence-based and statistical data and meta-analysis to drive thoughtful and rational decisions in the medical community, but it translated, I think, and continues to translate well to the sort of interventions that we try to do with respect to changing people's behavior and moving forward. What we know is that our gut reactions to things, and I'll just pick on one carefully here, but our gut reactions to a lot of things that seem like they ought to work, when you really look at the data, don't always work. And a good example of that around the country was the investment in boot camps. It seemed, and this is the one that's often touted, it seems like it ought to work, and it feels good. You know, we want those guys sort of marching and showing respect and all that stuff. But what we know, and it seems obvious if you look at the data after the fact, but what do we know about what happens to somebody when boot camp ends? Well, when boot camp ends, you actually get a job, and they give you a place to live, and they give you work to do, and they tell you where you're going to get your three meals, and they move you forward in sort of that process. Boot camp isn't the end of the military experience. It's only the beginning of it. And all the rest of the stuff they do for you happens after boot camp. Well, at the end of our boot camp, we kick you out on the street. We don't necessarily, you know, give you employment, and we don't give you clothes to wear, and we don't give you a place to live, and we don't promise you where your three squares are going to come from. And so it's no surprise that it hasn't had the kind of impact, I think, that people originally thought it did, because it felt good. And that's what we're trying to actually do with Senate Bill 267, is not waste the very limited and precious state dollars we have on programs that feel good but don't actually produce the results of reducing recidivism and keeping the public safe from offenders who will in fact reoffend. There's a lot of data from a lot of different places, and if you're interested, Representative would be happy to get you even maybe just a bibliography or a reading list of potential resources on the subject.
Thanks a lot. And also just your sort of guidance in our decision-making process to keep it on our minds, right? I mean, you're someone of significant esteem in this building and beyond, and having, you know, as we're thinking about how to make these decisions, keeping that in mind is hugely valuable. I won't belabor the committee with any more words.
All right. Other comments? Any other questions? Max, thank you very much.
Yeah, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
I was going to say, we'll save them for session. For
Max. He'll be back.
Another representative elect just showed up, and introduced Wally Hicks over on my right, your left. He's the new representative from Josephine County. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, welcome aboard, and we look forward to working with you as well.
Thanks, Senator.
All right, so our next informational meeting topic is the Task Force on Court Filing Fees, and I'm not sure, do we have our...
The hallway.
All right. So Senator Verger is coming forward, and I believe Representative Nathanson may be joining us as well. Senator Verger? We're ready for you. And you two were the only ones I had down that were going to present. Did you have anyone else that you wanted to have with you?
I don't know of anybody unless you want John Hollins.
Well, if we need a lifeline at some point, we can always grab one.
That would be nice.
Just for Friday. Is that a legislative business?
I think they want the lifeline to be up with the dais here. Thank you for all three being here, and whoever likes to get started.
Absolutely. I'm Joanne Verger. I'm a state senator from District 5, which is on the coast of Oregon from Coos Bay to Lincoln City. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, both chairmen, having us here this afternoon. This is really a great day for us. Representative Nathanson and I have been co-chairing a committee that was formed by House Bill 2287, and this House bill was very specific in what they wanted this committee to do. It was to review the collection and distribution of the court revenues, to review national justice system funding models and identify best practices, to recommend a structure to simplify the fee structure and the distribution and use of revenues, and to develop proposed legislation. You have with you a handout that I'm certainly not going to read it to you. If you'll follow along with me, I'd like to draw your attention to some things. Obviously, the judicial branch requires funding. And a part of the work of this committee was to look at what had been past practices and what we could do and what we could determine by information that we could gather that would help us come up with findings. And this, I believe, was done with great transparency. We met 13 times. We had lots of public hearings, and on the back of this sheet, you will see the people that testified. They were from all different areas of life. to tell us whether it was the court user or whether it was the professional that came and testified before us. And so if you'll look at this first line, the primary objective there, where it does require adequate funding, then the next one, which I'm going to not address because you can read this yourself, are the key policy questions that we had to address. But what I want to draw your attention to are the committee findings, because the judicial branch had been historically funded by the general fund, and a fee-for-service model could hinder access to justice because of prohibitively high fees needed to cover the cost of court services. And court users are willing to pay reasonable fees to maintain open and access to the courts. Now, some of the information that we got was from the National Court Association. And so you're going to see in this next one their study, and the other thing that you'll see is the State Bar Association report. You have a binder that was presented to you today, and you will have in your binder the Oregon State Bar Court Fee Task Force, and you will have a summary of the NCSC study. And so what we looked at then was what the bar looking at 2287 and the impacts, what the study showed, then the national best practices, and then the legislative concept that came from that. The next one was the statutory review structure. Again, the why, the key policy, and what did the committee find? Well, civil fee and criminal fines structures are inordinately complex, with the fees and fines located throughout the statutes. The number and complexity of fees makes it difficult to predict and uniformly apply fees, and there are many add-on to fees. Now, if you will look, it shows that the national study came to the conclusion that Oregon's court fee structure is more complex than comparative states. And then you see the best practices and on. Then the sources of revenue. The current revenue sources needed to be evaluated for their impact on access to justice. That was a very, very serious discussion in the committee. Everybody wanted to make sure that there was not any hindrance to access to justice and the efficient access of the courts by other users. So what did the committee find? Well, the committee found that inequities, inequities exist within the current fee structure. Unpredictable fees and fines impede access to justice, and violation fines are not transparent. The uses of the revenue. There needs to be a clear understanding of what services court-generated revenue funds. The direct distribution of court-generated revenue distributions lack transparency. The legislature itself lacks efficient fiduciary oversight over programs receiving dedicated court revenues. And then the administration of those revenues. The revenue administration function needs to be efficient, cost-effective, and positioned for automation. The number and complexity of fees we found make it difficult for the courts and the court users to predict and uniformly apply the fees. Revenue distributions are complex, and they involve significant accounting resources. On the back, you will see the people that testified, the public testimony, how many committee hearings we held, the committee work groups that I've already talked to you about, then the task forces, and when they met, the comparative analysis, and the committee documents, which you have been provided for today. Now, this has not all been with great cheerleaders, and I want to tell you some of the reasons for that. Changes need to be made in this system. It has come from almost everyone that we need to do something. And so change is very frightening. It causes great stress in people regardless of what you're trying to change. It's only when you rather accept change as a way of life that it becomes comfortable. And so change is inevitable, and I think that as you look at the work that's been done by the committee, the transparency, the sincerity of purpose that is behind it, you will become more comfortable with the changes that need to be made. Now, out of this, as you remember, we were instructed to come up with legislation. And so I'm going to turn to my partner now and my colleague, Representative Nathanson, who will talk a little bit about that requirement that we met.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you, Senator Berger. I'd like to start by recalling just a couple of points that Senator Verger had mentioned that lead us to the recommendations that you see proposed in these legislative concept draft bills. Inequities exist with the current fee structure. Fees and fines are unpredictable, and we find that it impedes access to justice and that there is unfairness. When you look at what happens from one court or one county to another, what can happen to one citizen who happens to be driving too fast in one area, they may be sent to a municipal court or a justice court or a circuit court, and depending where they're sent, there may be a different system of fees. There's no such thing as a fine is a fine is a fine. And in fact, what's printed on your ticket isn't necessarily what you're going to pay. It may be more or less than what is really happening. And we found this to be confusing, not only for the committee to see the variety of variation from one place to another, but what must this be like to an Oregonian to think that it's fair from one county to another when the system is not predictable like that? So the national best practices mentioned that fees should be simplified, surcharges should not be established, and fees should be periodically reviewed. In doing all of that, it leads to the changes that you see, which are significant. And as the Senator has mentioned, change can be uncomfortable. It can be a little bit difficult, but it's absolutely time to consider this. I also want to put to rest something that may come up eventually, and I'd rather just get it out on the table. It has been mentioned a couple of times, so you guys are just trying to raise a lot more revenue, aren't you? Well, if 2287 went away, the surcharges, it's true there would be less revenue for the court system, but the point was not to raise revenue above what we're raising now. The point was to basically raise the same amount of revenue, but to do it in a more fair, a more predictable, and a more cost-effective and efficient way. So, on the civil side, you have two bills, and it's because the issues were, even though some of the objectives are the same, whether we're talking about civil or criminal, we needed to treat them as two separate groups. So on the civil side, legislative concept 1168, the following principles were used. The fee amount is standardized. It is transparent because it will be in statute. Multiple county assessments are consolidated into a civil filing fee structure. There are no longer any add-on fees or assessments. They are included in the filing fee structure. Revenue will flow into the general fund, and an account is established to distribute the funds to specified entities that are receiving funds now, and the distribution amounts will be set in statute. I'm going to if it's all right with the chair, instead of going through the detail of each fine amount and each bullet point, I'll just skip that.
Yeah, the 50,000 foot level would be great.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to skip over all of that. So, on the criminal side, you'll see that some of the objectives and principles are the same. We're simplifying the revenue structure. We're maintaining the current revenue stream that you see in the 09-11 biennium. The fine amount will be transparent because the amount will be on the ticket. It won't be, here's a number that seems to be arbitrary and you may be paying more or you may be paying less. It will be what is actually printed there. It will eliminate variations in fines based on the court that a person was cited to and on what are really unknown to the public, the discretionary practices of each individual circuit, municipal, and justice court. It will simplify or eliminate administrative procedures for courts. There will be no longer any add-on fees or assessments because a single fee will now include it all. There is uniformity in the distribution of the infraction revenue. All revenue will flow into the criminal fines account. The distributions occur through a budgetary process, and we will increase the accountability for distributions. The legislature will determine the priorities and outcomes. So I'd like to conclude this by saying that I think it's important to understand, again, this was not some gimmick for raising revenue. This was a very serious task that had been assigned to us. How do we make the system more efficient, more fair, more transparent, and more predictable? And we recognize that it is critical to maintain revenue for the courts, to maintain revenue for the e-court project, and to maintain revenue that is flowing to the local jurisdictions. Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Chair Pazanski and Representative Barker, I would like to recognize some of the members that are at the dais today who have done a lot of lifting with us in this work, and that is Senator Bonamici, Senator Whitsitt, Representative Garrett, and at the dais with us was Representative Benz from the Bar Association, was Mr. Chris Kent, and from the Justice Department was Mr. Doug Bray. So,
thank you for those acknowledgments. Questions, comments? Representative Bart, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you, Mr. Chair?
Doing well, thank you.
Representative Nathanson, on the traffic, so what was referred to as bail on a citation will now be, is that the final answer? If it says $250, so there's no need to go to court to try to get a judge to mitigate it, it's going to be $250?
Correct. And the number that was determined is actually lower than the maximum amount that's printed now. There was a very thorough analysis done of the average of once you take away what had been waived and what's the maximum a judge can reduce it and so forth, and you average all of that out, that's the number that was chosen.
And I don't know if you know what that number is, but I mean, in the last years when I was working, it seems like running a red light was something like $270 or something in Portland. And I would find at night, I'd stop some driver who ran a red light, and went through a light late, and I would find it to be some waitress on her way home, single mother and everything, and I'd take a look at that number and take a look at the person, the citizen, and I would say, you know, it's a $274 ticket, and then your insurance is going to go up. So how about pretend you got the ticket, pretend your insurance went up, and, you know, really be careful. And because it just seemed like, I mean, if I got a $274 ticket, I could pay it. That wouldn't, you know, really, I mean, I wouldn't like to, but I could do it. But there's a lot of people who couldn't, and I was really concerned about that. Those numbers seemed to get, from when I started, it would have been $15 for running a red light.
represent Tomé.
Thank you. This is the first I've seen of this. I've sort of heard rumblings of it. Both of you did a great presentation. But and so I'm unfamiliar with this, and I don't think I was on the committee when it was first brought up. But the one thing I am familiar with is people who get a ticket for Dewey, driving under the influence. And so part of that goes for alcohol and drug treatment programs. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that there's a nexus, and I imagine there are lots of examples of that. So how would you deal with people who are involved in the alcohol and drug treatment programs? How would that be, those fines be allocated to them?
I'll give you a general statement and then rely on Senator Berger or staff to amplify or clarify if I misstate this. It is the intent to continue to fund, whether it's on the civil side or the criminal side, to continue to fund the programs that are being funded, just to collect the revenue and distribute the money in a more efficient way. But the intent is to continue to fund the programs that have been funded, the same list of programs, and as you've pointed out, there is a nexus between the purpose and where the money came from.
Could I have a follow-up?
Let me see if I can give a clarification as well. Maybe you can respond to this as well. It would be my understanding that what we're talking about is the fine and assessments, that if you have someone that's actually convicted of DUII, or if they're going into the diversion program, they're going to be referred to a treatment provider. After they go through an evaluation, they will still be required to pay those costs. This one fee is not going to cover those costs because those are incidental to what their terms and conditions would be for their probation.
If I could just follow up,
you
then, and I don't want to belabor this, but it seems to me that the legislature has passed all kinds of fees, and maybe local jurisdictions have passed fees where there was a nexus. That's what they intended the money to go for. Now it makes me uncomfortable to think about it going in the general fund, and somebody else is going to make decisions about where that money goes.
Mr. Well, Chair. I can say that no programs are going to go away. I think I can safely say, with what has been done, the work of this committee, that no programs will go away.
Now, I follow up. But we can't commit that in future legislatures, right? All we know is that now, that might be the case, but you and I might not be here in 4 years or 6 years or 8 years, hopefully.
I just had a letter to something to that effect, that could I promise that the legislature would never touch the money that was designated.
Right.
And I'm sorry, but I can't, because legislators do what legislators can do. Mm-hmm. And so that happens.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for your helpful explanation. It got me off the hook, and there's a list in this legislative concept of the eligible entities, and all those programs are actually recommended to be listed in statute to make sure that it's on record which programs should be funded.
Earlier, Chair Barker made the comment, well, that's the end of it. I think he was referring to the number that's on the uniform traffic citation, the supposed bail or fine. So is that number, is that the number that has to be imposed by the judge, or is this turning into mandatory sentencing on traffic violations?
Under this, it's very standardized. In fact, the discussion has come up and has been suggested that you would not have some of the access to the court that you have now, and that has been a debate and disturbing to committee members. For instance, the letter that you're able to write to be able to get your fine reduced. And so the way it is right now, you would actually have to go to court. And that is a concern. It's a concern of the courts. It's also a concern of people that would maybe not want to provide an open way for people to get the fine reduced. So those are things that you know, you will have for discussion. What we want today is to move this forward in the process. And you've heard the names of the people that have come up with what you're going to have and have at your dais today. And so we want you now, all the certified smart people on this judiciary, to help us move this forward with your input. And the things that you see that we missed are things that need to be improved upon. But this is, I think, the message here today is that it needs to be changed. It's too complex, and we're more complex than other states. And that we need to do something that helps people understand not only the person coming into the court, but your lawyer, that he knows exactly what it's going to cost you and that he's able to tell you that before you get there. So I think there are a lot of benefits to this, but we just hope that we can move this along in the process.
All right. Senator, I would hope always that, you know, when grandma or some young gal, the first day she drives her car at 16, she hits the road, that somehow fairness and justice comes into a process. And if we're getting there are so many different circumstances surrounding a specific type of crime, speeding, a stop sign, and not to have the court have a good open access to the court for the purpose of explaining the difference in circumstances and how something came about, I would have a lot of trouble with that.
Well, go ahead.
Along those lines, there's a couple things. One, I remember seeing somebody get a citation in a school zone in Portland, and it doubled because it's a school zone, and then the officer told the person, well, if you go to court, the judge can reduce it. Well, the judge couldn't reduce the school zone up there, so then, of course, the person was really upset about wasting a day going to court. But another thing I've seen in court where you're in there for your fifth speeding ticket, the judge takes a little more hard line on that, and this seems to be like it would just be the same as if it was your first. Doesn't matter if we have if you have a set number for a certain speed.
And we'll have to let me just interject a little bit here. I think that we see what I call that 50,000 foot level, and there's a lot of discussions, a lot of opportunity that we'll have. Seeing some of the other people that have participated, I don't think they were closing the door on the judges, because clearly it could go either way for someone who has multiple offender as compared to someone that doesn't have the ability to pay. There's a lot of factors here. We'll have a lot of great people that are going to be here for this next session, and we'll all be, let's say, putting our noodles together and coming out with the best product we can. And so I know that Senator Onomichi wanted to make a comment, but I do want to say that we are not going to solve any issues today. This is just like, hey, this is out there.
I vote aye.
Thank you very much for all the work you've done on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you just recognize me?
I did.
Okay. I couldn't tell because everybody was talking. If it was my turn.
Thank you.
I'm either going to make people feel a lot better or a lot worse, but the comment I want to make is that as a member of the committee, and I think the other people on this dais who have served in these meetings can agree, not every member of the committee agreed with every aspect of this, and I just don't want to leave the impression with either the committee or the people listening that every member of the committee is firmly committed to every aspect of either of these bills. But there were times when we said we're going to move this along and get it through the process and get to have the hearings on it and discuss it. So just to hope that alleviates some people's concerns, or maybe I made more people concerned than alleviated concerns, but there were times when we just wanted to move it forward, so we said let's move the bill forward and have the discussion. So I hope that's helpful.
Thank you.
So hopefully that will take care of most of the issues. I do want to just ask one question. I understand that you have your last work session group meeting on the 17th, and my understanding you have LC 1168 is your vehicle that is going to be used. I understand there may be some various amendments that may be considered. Are you thinking about making a modification to the LC 1168 at this point, or are you going to just bring it in as the LC with the amendments to be considered in the future?
I'm not aware of it. There's one comment, Mr. Chair, there's one comment I'd like to make and then ask Mr. Borden to clarify the process. I was remiss in not mentioning to you there is a third aspect that we are forwarding, which is a joint committee on state courts revenue structure. That was another thing that had been mentioned from the national best practices, that you have to have a way to review these things, that it doesn't stay fixed forever. And so there is that third, there's the 364, 1168, and 1168-1. There's that third concept.
Chair Przanski and Chair Barker and members of the committee, the only modification that I'm currently aware of is on the criminal legislative concept 364. It currently, pardon me, has some blanks in it for the allocation amounts to the entities, and we're working on developing what those allocation amounts are, similar to what their funding levels have currently been, just to have set placeholders in. But that is, at this point, the only thing I'm aware of.
Okay. Yeah, from my perspective, the chair on the Senate side, I would prefer not having a bunch of amendments adopted based on what we know that's out there now, and we'll consider any and all in the future. Any other comments? Thank you all very much for being here and sharing. All right, so our next informational meeting topic is going to be the researcher safety for Oregon Health Sciences University. I have Phil Donovan, Janet Billups, Dr. is it Masuda? Masadi, sorry. And then also Andrea Myers also asked to be able to make some comments. So if you three will take those seats, Andrea, I'll have you over here so we can just streamline through. And we want to try to stay on schedule. If you can do that for us.
We'll keep it very concise, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan. As you all know, Oregon Health and Science University houses world-class research programs, and our ability to attract and retain the best researchers in the world and bringing them to Oregon is you have to ensure their safety. The Oregon legislature has played a very important role in the continued success of efforts to keep researchers and staff at the Oregon National Primate Research Center safe. Following the passage of House Bill 3094 in 2009, which extended OHSU's redaction authority for 2 years, we set about a review of our internal redaction process. We did this past spring. We did this per our conversations with the Judiciary Committee, and we wanted to come back today to give you a little report on the discussions that we had. With me today is Janet Billups, who's legal counsel at OHSU. She will describe our efforts to ensure that all animal record requests for information, that they're treated equally, and that staff at OHSU, that they all have an accurate understanding of the process that should be followed. Also with me is Dr. Ilham Masoudi. She's going to talk about the obligation to inform the public about taxpayer-funded research, ensuring access to information by watchdog organizations, while at the same time taking reasonable steps to ensure the safety of researchers at ONPRC. I want to also just acknowledge that earlier you pre-sessioned filed legislation that would extend redaction authority for 6 years. We appreciate the fact that you've taken that action so that we can have this important debate. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Janet.
Good afternoon, Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Janet Billups. I'm legal counsel at OHSU, and as Phil mentioned, I'm really here to report on one task that you gave us at the end of the last session. When the research protection law was initially adopted, we were asked very specifically by the committee at that time to develop a process that would ensure that the law would not be used to withhold information from the media. So we proceeded to do that, and in fact, I think in the last session you had access to a document called Process to Review and Decide Upon Public Records Requests Subject to HB 3093. And that document outlined the different processes that we used based on whether the requester was a member of the media or a member of the general public. Things change, orientation shifts, and in the last session we were asked to update our process in order to ensure that all requesters were and are treated consistently. So we went about doing that, as Phil mentioned. All the staff who works in this field reviewed the existing process. It was a very useful exercise for us. And one thing that we discovered is that, in fact, although our process may have granted the discretion to act differently per the direction of the previous committee, in practice, that was not followed. And in practice, all of our requesters, including the media, have been treated consistently. However, what we did is we updated our process to ensure that it reflects the practice that we followed, and it conforms to the guidance that you gave us last time, which is to ensure that everyone's treated equally. Thank you.
Chair Przanski and Chair Parker, members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Ilham Misaudi, and first of all, on behalf of all the scientists at the Oregon National Research Primate Center, NOHSU, I would like to thank you for giving me an opportunity to address you today. I am an assistant professor at the Oregon National Primate Research Center. My research focuses on understanding why older individuals are more vulnerable to infection compared to adults, and it is our belief that by understanding the changes in their immune system with age, we can actually design some novel vaccine and therapeutic strategies that are specifically targeted for this vulnerable population. The federal government funds most of our research efforts, and as such, we have an obligation to the public to keep them informed of our research goals and the advances that we make on a daily basis towards improving human health and well-being. We do this by posting information on our website, by publishing scientific papers, and by providing the funding agencies with regular progress reports, as well as by speaking to the members of the public when they tour our primate center. Unfortunately, over the last few years, we've seen some tactics used by the animal rights extremists, who we define as individuals who use illegal and menacing means to incite violence against scientists and animal caregivers. These tactics have shifted from targeting institutions to targeting individuals. Several of my colleagues have been harassed in their own homes, have had their cars, their homes vandalized, the neighbors were approached, and it's been a very stressful time. The information that animal rights extremists use to incite violence against scientists is mostly extracted from animal records, since these records keep very, very detailed information of the daily life of the animal. It is very easy to take information out of this document and use it out of context. For example, an animal could have injured itself in an incident that is completely unrelated to the research project in which this animal has been involved. And therefore, with this animal, there were required specific care or stitches, for example. This information can actually then be extracted out of this animal record along with the names of the animal caretaker who provided this animal with care and the scientist. This information, unfortunately, is then used out of context, posted on websites, along with home addresses, and usually very often combined with a call of violence against this individual who now can be depicted as committing cruelty towards animal in this incident taken out of context. Redacting researchers' names and staff names from animal records will prevent misuse of information. It will still provide the requester with complete access to all the daily information regarding this animal care. The redacting of the information will not at all interfere with the ability of any concerned individual to monitor the well-being of an animal, monitor the care it's been giving, and should a concern arise, redacting the names of scientists and staff does not at all in any way inhibit this concerned individual from contacting the proper authorities and alerting them to a potential problem. And proper authorities such as the USDA, for example, have complete access to the name of scientists and animal caretakers, and they can conduct a full investigation because they have access to all this information. So in summary, animal activism and extremism must be counteracted in two ways, we believe, by protecting the scientists whose mission is to improve our daily life and our health, and by promoting open discourse at the same time. And we're trying to strike that balance on a daily basis. We believe, and OHSU believes, that release of animal records without the individual's names will provide meaningful access to animal health records without jeopardizing the safety of those of us who work on a daily basis to improve our well-being. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, we'll do questions for this part first.
Just a quick question to Phil. If you'll remember in your third bullet on your paragraph last year, or 2 years ago, where are we on the web page? Because the issue we had last time around here was pretty simple, and that is that the web page had the name, the picture, and I don't recall if yours was on there, doctor, and everything you possibly did. So it was all you had to do was take the name, plug it into Google, and you found the person, or you stalked them as soon as they walked out of the building. Did the university get to the point of where they fixed the web page so we didn't tell 100% of them anything on the web page to start with, and this law was useless? You don't know the answer.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Boquist. We understand the perspective. We've discussed at length the issue that you raised as it relates to photos being placed on OHSU's websites. And I guess the challenge and what we've discussed was trying to strike that balance between informing the public and keeping researchers safe. And you should know that at OHSU, quite a few of the researchers do not put their photos up online.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So if I think I heard you, what you said here, Phil, in simple terms, is that if the researcher or if the doctor here didn't want to have her information up there, it's not put up. So it's really each professor is making their own choice now, because it's hard for us to protect a professor who then puts their entire life bio up there with their picture and their name, and it takes all 35 seconds to find out who they are. It doesn't do any good to redact records. So it's really a personal choice at this point, is what you're saying.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, that's correct.
Counsel, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And if somebody makes a ask for the information, if it's already going and asked, and the U.S. Humane Society, Humane Society of the U.S. or whatever that, the East Coast group, if they both said, would they both get the same information?
Chair Barker, the answer is yes. The request is handled by different offices, though. So media requests are built a lot on relationships between our media staff and the media. They may end up saying, the media may end up saying that they don't want all of the information, but if they do, we give it to them, the same as the U.S. Humane Society.
Okay, thank you.
Which means that we would withhold the name of animal researchers in the media request as well.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that the Attorney General is doing a review and revamping of all of the public records laws. Do you know if that effort overlaps with what you're doing or is in conflict with what you're doing or proposing?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, to our knowledge, and we have, I've paid attention to that process as well, there's not been any indication that specific exemptions are under review, and certainly nor have we gotten any information that this particular exemption is part of that initiative.
Thank you.
And to that end, Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, we sat down and met with the Attorney General's office this past summer, and frankly, we ended up on a much different topic.
I'm not sure what that means, Mr. Donner.
We probably won't go there.
But that's okay.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Andrea.
Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity to very briefly comment because I look forward to the opportunity next session to have a fuller hearing on this. And I just want to clarify and remind the committee briefly that the ACLU has never opposed the redaction of the home address, but simply the name of the researcher on public documents. And a few quick points. It is our understanding over the many years, and this law, I believe, is close to 10 years that it's been in place, so I was hoping to hear testimony that the safety issue was addressed after this long and not the continued fear that's ongoing. But in our talking to folks who have attempted to access the records and the log and material that's been presented to the committee over the years, that there is a different treatment depending on who the requester is, so we'll look forward to seeing that log and how it's reflected. In addition, as all of you who are elected officials and know that what you do gets scrutinized by the public, and you're therefore aware that what you say and what you do often gets taken out of context. And that indeed is the risk and the wonderful nature of public records and public oversight and scrutiny, and we can't legislate against that, nor do I think we would want to. We also can't legislate or shouldn't legislate when it comes to the public record, who is asking for it and for what purpose, and continue to be disturbed about the segregation from the media, and indeed in the more recent policy that they had, it wasn't the media and the general public. Indeed, the policy said it was the media and animal rights organizations. And finally, I just think what we've heard over the years is it's very important for watchdog groups to be able to link the name with the particular research project and the protocols federally, and that it is not so easy as being presented here today that you can do the watchdog oversight activity sufficiently that the redaction does not create problems. Indeed, it does. But with that, we look forward to the opportunity to further discuss this with both sides or of the chambers and to provide whatever information you need. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Meyer? Thank all four of you for coming forward, and we'll continue this discussion during the next session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And our next informational meeting topic is adding tribal police officers to the definition of peace officer. And we have a group that's going to be here. I've got four names here, but I saw more than four, so I'm not sure who's coming.
There are four.
Okay, so Ms. Stewart, Sauls, Haldeman, and Ross. Okay, so who's going to take the lead? And if you're in it, for all of you, I need you to introduce yourself as you speak so it's on the record, and then go ahead and go forward. Thanks.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Honorable Chairman and committee members. My name is Jim Soles, and I'm the recently retired general manager of Public Safety Branch of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. I'm appearing today on behalf of the tribe to testify regarding the legislative proposal before you. I began my law enforcement career in 1971 as a tribal police officer at Warm Springs. Since then, my career has included service as chief of police in Warm Springs, McMinnville, Redmond, and for 23 years for the city of Prineville. I returned to Warm Springs in 2007 and retired 2 months ago as the public safety general manager. So my experience in both tribal and non-tribal law enforcement, I think I can tell you how critically important it is that the 2011 Oregon legislature enact the proposal before you. The draft bill before you addresses the very serious public safety problem we now face at Warm Springs because of the State v. Kurtz decision by the Oregon Court of Appeals earlier this year. I'd like to focus my testimony on the Kurtz ruling and its impact on the Warm Springs Police Department and on the Columbia River Intertribal Law Enforcement Program, which enforces Warm Springs Treaty Indian fishing laws on the Columbia River. The Kurtz case arose on the Warm Springs Reservation when a Warm Springs officer patrolling U.S. Highway 26 on the reservation witnessed Mr. Kurtz driving in the opposite direction, acting suspiciously. Our officer turned around, activated his lights, and tried to get Mr. Kurtz to pull over. Mr. Kurtz refused to pull over and made a dash for the border. He continued to drive on Highway 26 to the bridge that crosses the Deschutes River and marched the boundary of the reservation. The Warm Springs officer activated his siren and continued in hot pursuit of Mr. Kurtz across the bridge and off the reservation, eventually getting him to pull over. Mr. Kurtz resisted the arrest and was subdued with the assistance of additional police officers, and our officer cited him into the Oregon State Court for attempting to elude a police officer and resisting arrest by a police officer. The citations were issued to state court in Madras because Mr. Kurtz is a non-Indian, and under current federal court decisions, the tribe lacks criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians. And because Mr. Kurtz's actions eluding and resisting arrest occurred in part outside the reservation in Jefferson County. In court, Mr. Kurtz attacked the two citations on the basis that the Warm Springs officer was not a police officer or a peace officer within the meaning of the two Oregon criminal offenses, attempting to elude and resisting arrest, for which he was charged. Judge Ahern of the Jefferson County Circuit Court disagreed and noted that if the facts were in reverse, if it was a state officer in hot pursuit of a suspect onto the reservation, Warm Springs tribal law would recognize the state officer as a police officer and allow the state officer to cite that offender into state court. Unfortunately, on appeal, the Oregon Court of Appeals reversed Judge Ahern and dismissed the charges against Mr. Kurtz on the grounds that Oregon's attempting to elude and resisting arrest criminal statutes do not include tribal officers within their definition of police officer or peace officer. The Court of Appeals decision has created a serious public safety problem for our tribal officers who represent the primary law enforcement agency on the 1,000 square miles of the Warm Springs Indian Reservation. Thousands of non-Indians travel across the reservation each year on U.S. Highway 26. Warm Springs officers are the only responders to traffic accidents on the reservation and often are the first responders or oftentimes only responders to accidents off the reservation in Jefferson, Wasco, and Clackamas counties. Now, however, since the Kurtz decision, whenever our officers encounter a non-Indian suspect at an accident scene or elsewhere, they have a legitimate concern about their personal safety when investigating and detaining a non-Indian offender for a violation of state or federal law. In addition, our officers are now hesitant to respond to calls for assistance, helping neighboring law enforcement agencies outside the reservation. This is particularly a serious problem because of the location of a convenience store and abandoned gas station just outside the reservation on Highway 26 that is the site of numerous police calls. We are the closest law enforcement agency to this location, which is otherwise patrolled by Jefferson County and the Oregon State Police. Even after the Kurtz decision, we do respond to calls for assistance from neighboring agencies at this location and elsewhere, but we're now very concerned about what authority and what legal status and protection our officers have, if any, outside the reservation. The problems created by the Kurtz decision are even more acute with the Columbia River Intertribal Law Enforcement Program. These officers who carry Warm Springs Police Department commissions enforce the treaty Indian fishing laws of the Warm Springs, Umatilla, Nez Perce, and Yakima tribes on a 150-mile stretch of the Columbia River. However, these officers often encounter non-Indian state law violators in the course of their marine and highway patrols. After the Kurtz decision, it is questionable whether these officers have authority to issue any Oregon State Court criminal citations, and it certainly cannot cite offenders in Oregon State Court for resisting arrest and attempting to elude. When police officers are not protected by criminal laws designed to protect law enforcement personnel, such as attempting to elude and resisting arrest statutes at issue in Kurtz, it makes the job of a tribal law enforcement not only extremely difficult, but also very dangerous. Speaking for the Warm Springs Tribe and as a former officer and police chief in McMinnville, Redmond, and Prineville, I feel strongly that the state legislature must act swiftly to correct the Kurtz decision. Tribal officers should have the same status and same protection under Oregon statutes as other state and federal officers. Accordingly, I urge you in the strongest possible terms to move forward with this legislative proposal before you. And I thank you very much for your time.
All right, thank you. Now, before the next three speak, let me just give you some time frame. We're on a short time. I want to make certain we have enough time to answer questions, if there are any questions. We have the statements that you are going to, I guess, be providing. Let Mr. Soles go, because I think that gave us a general discussion. I have not had a chance to skim read each of yours. So if you can be concise in your statements, because we're going to be back and doing this during the regular session. This is more of an overview of what we're doing. And so if we can narrow it to high points that you think we need to know besides what we've already heard, that would be greatly appreciated.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chairman and committee members. My name is Tim Edelman. I'm the Chief of Police for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. And I'd like to add that I've been in law enforcement for almost 33 years. Actually, November was 33 years. And nearly 25 of those, I was a member of the Washoe County Sheriff's Office, where I retired as a patrol lieutenant. I will try and expedite through this, not read through this. What I wanted to brief you on was the training that tribal police officers receive and some issues of criminal enforcement on reservation situations. Our officers are hired just like any other officer in compliance with DPSST hiring standards. Our officers then go to the 16-week academy and complete that successfully. They return to the tribe where they will go through a field training evaluation program with a field training officer. At the end of that, they have a field training manual that DPSST, we sign it off and submit that documentation to DPSST. At the end of 9 months, successful completion and all the employment requirements DPSST has, the officer can then receive their basic certification. Our officers receive that and other certifications, which they're eligible through promotion and formal education, such as intermediate, advanced, supervision, middle management, and executive certifications. In order to maintain their certification, we follow the same maintenance standards that other police officers, just like deputy sheriffs or city municipal police officers do, in that every 3 years we have to maintain our first aid and CPR certification, and we also have to do an additional 84 hours of training at the department, which includes 8 hours of annual firearms training and use of force issues. We'll continue to do that. We've always done that, and we'll follow all the same standards that DPSST mandates, and we'll continue to do that as well. One of the things, when the Kurtz decision was handed down, it created a dilemma not only off the reservation, but particularly on reservation issues. With the Kurtz decision, if we don't have deputation from our local sheriff's office, we can only enforce tribal codes on tribal members or Indians. We don't have any jurisdiction over non-Indians on the reservation. So I'd just like to give you a couple of examples that highlights that. If we were to respond to a domestic disturbance within the boundaries of the reservation, I might add, our reservation, our community is roughly, we have a population of roughly 5,000 people, and half that are non-Indian residents. So if we responded to a domestic that involved two non-Indians, our officers would have no jurisdiction over them. And if we responded there just to stabilize the situation and hoping that we could get a deputy to respond or a state police officer, while we're there, if something were to happen and one of the officers were assaulted, there's no crime committed against the officer. Because of the Kurtz ruling, we are not police officers. Another situation would be, we have thousands of people who go through our reservation visiting or passing through. One of the biggest things you read about in the newspapers these days are motorists driving 100 plus miles per hour. If we had a motorist drive through the reservation at 100 plus miles an hour and one of our officers tried to stop it, we would only have authority to stop and detain if it was a non-Indian. We would not have authority to take any action on it. And again, we would have to stop and wait for a state police officer or a sheriff's deputy, if anybody were available or even could respond, to take action against that person. On the other hand, if that non-Indian continued to elude and speed away, it would be no traffic crime, again, because we have no designation as a police officer under the statutes. So those are kind of the highlights that I wanted to point across with the Kurtz decision. One of the things, we just want to make sure that any decision, we want to proceed with this so that officers are going to have protection, our communities are going to have the same protection other communities do, and when it comes down to it, we conform to all the standards, professional standards, that other police officers do, and by us not being included, this is also is a matter of fairness to be able to be included in that same situation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Urbana Ross. I'm the Chief Operations Officer for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, and under my authority is the Public Safety Branch. I'd also like to introduce one of our tribal council members in the audience, Ole Pat Jr. The Kurtz decision shined a light on a problem with the Oregon's criminal and traffic codes, but the problem is larger than just the two criminal statutes at issue in the Kurtz case. The resisting arrest and attempting to elude crimes. The bigger problem is that with two exceptions, one involving eligibility of tribal officers for police training and certification through the Oregon Department of Public Safety and Standards and Training, and one involving disciplinary action against public safety officers. Tribal police officers in Oregon are not included in the definition of police officers. Peace officers are law enforcement officers that appear throughout Oregon's criminal and traffic code. The fallout from this broad exclusion is not only that criminals who resist arrest and elude tribal officers go unpunished because the tribal officers cannot cite them into state court. The tribal and federal courts often lack jurisdiction. The further fallout is that tribal officers may lack the basic authority to cite criminals into state court for any offense. In many situations, like the hot pursuit off the reservation in the Kurtz case, or the Marine patrols on the Columbia River outside the Indian land, or encounters with non-Indians over whom tribe lacks criminal jurisdiction, tribal officers have no alternative exception to cite offenders into state court. But if tribal officers are not considered police officers or peace officers under Oregon law, their authority to issue these citations is questionable and certainly subject to challenges by the criminal defendant in state court. While it is true that deputization from the local sheriff's office offers a stopgap solution to this problem and allows state deputized tribal officers to enforce state law on and off the reservation against non-Indians, assurance of such deputization depends on the willingness of the sheriff. As often, until very recent, Warm Springs officers have had no sheriff's deputization for most of the past 20 years. Deputization agreements are even more challenging for the Columbia River Intertribal law enforcement officers who patrol the Columbia River in seven separate Oregon counties. The bill before you offers a straightforward, permanent solution to this problem. The bill treats tribal officers who have been certified as having successfully completed the DPSST training program, the same training program that state and local officers must complete, the same as other state and local police officers and peace officers under Oregon law. Specifically, if tribal officers meet the requirements of this legislation, they will be empowered to enforce Oregon criminal and traffic laws, and they will also receive the same protection and coverage under Oregon criminal statutes as other state and local officers. The bill also addresses any issues regarding liability. Tribal officers are expressly declared not to be employees of the state or any local government entities. Any liability for the action of the tribal officers enforcing Oregon criminal and traffic codes would be addressed by the tribal officers' tribal employer. All Oregon tribes with police departments provide a mechanism for hearing and resolving liability claims against tribal employees, including police officers. Warm Springs strongly support the bill before you. We believe that it provides a straightforward and balanced legislative solution to the serious public safety problem illustrated in part by the Kurtz decision. The bill will also benefit state and local law enforcement agencies because it will enable tribal officers to assist those agencies in the enforcement of state law on and off the reservation, particularly in remote areas. We urge the committee to take action today to move this bill forward and help ensure its enactment by the 2011 legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rawls.
Good afternoon. Mine is pretty short, so I'll let you know. Members of the Senate and House Judiciary Committee, my name is Leo Stewart. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Umatilla Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation. I am honored to serve as a chair of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services. You have already heard the background and reasons why this legislation is very important to our people. I want to come here and let you know that our tribal government and the Warm Springs, Coos, and Coquille tribal governments have considered this issue and passed resolutions of support for its passage. Burns Paiute, which also has a tribal police department, is expected to do the same after they have a chance to review the bill's language. I also want to take time to acknowledge the value of the Commission on Indian Services and our government-to-government process. That process has allowed us to deliberate this issue among the tribes and provide an opportunity for input by our representatives to the Commission, Senator Ted Frerioli and Representative Arnie Wobin. Their insight and support has been valuable and helped lead to the legislation who you have before you. We thank you for allowing us time to present this issue and urge the prompt action so that our police officers can continue to keep both our community and your community safe. And I want to thank you for this time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions?
I just have a quick comment. I've trained for years in, I was a policeman for 31 years, and I've trained with tribal officers. I was amazed when this case came down that they weren't considered officers. They have the same training and certainly be working to help get this passed.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, are there any other states across the country that are experiencing something similar to this, what's happened with this Kurtz case?
This is a nationwide issue. I was down in Taos, New Mexico, off duty, and I witnessed an abduction starting to take place. And I got myself in the middle of it and tried to get help. A tribal police officer came by. I flagged him down, and he said, "I'd really like to help you, but I have absolutely no authority." I said, "Well, stick around anyway. You have a radio. Get us some help." And he did. But he was very concerned he'd be in trouble for interfering, which was an obvious abduction that was taking place. And he did stay, and we did stop it, and the local police arrived. But that is a nationwide issue that needs addressed.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a quick, it's not really a question, it's more of a comment for council. I was trying to multitask and read the Kurtz decision, but I couldn't really find it on my tiny little phone. So I'm wondering if perhaps this is something that can be, it seems like it should be simple.
It is.
But I wonder if it's something that involves federal law or
state
law. It's just changing the state law is going to take care of it.
Yeah, I've been briefed by individuals here at the table today. And others, this is a pretty direct, straightforward fix. Basically, what we have to do is just designate that tribal police will have the same force and authority as sworn police officers that are not tribal. The requirements that we already require, is going to go forward, is that everyone that is serving in the capacity as a tribal police do, in fact, have to go through DPSST, have to be sworn certified officers. It's just that we want to make certain that if they're out there, they can do their job, and they're not hindered.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did find a summary that suggested that there were sovereignty issues and federal law involved, and I just want to make sure that we can.
We'll look at that. But my understanding from that's already been briefed, and that's not should not be a problem.
Thank you.
I want to thank you all again for coming forward,
and we expect that we'll
move forward as quick as we can once we come into session in February.
Thank you for taking a long trip to get here.
Thank you. 2244.
All right, we're going into our next, we'll hold off on the next one for a minute. We've got three more items to cover today. We have about 30 minutes before the House is going to, members are going to be leaving for caucus meetings, at least some of them. And so because of that, I want to make sure we can get finished with the other two. So, Bill, we'll hold off on the next one. We'll go ahead and go with the Oregon Youth Authority. And I have Colette Peters and Brad Berry that are going to present for us on this one.
Is the Mr. D.A.?
All right, who would like to get us started?
I'll begin. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairs and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colette Peters, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and with me here today is Brad Berry, the District Attorney from Yamhill County, and also the Chair of the Juvenile Justice Systems Symposium Steering Committee. which makes his title even longer. In the interest of time, and I know you're pressed for it, we have distributed a 2-page briefing document on the status of the symposium and what we've done since the last time we had the opportunity to meet. So I will be brief, but before beginning, I wanted to recognize Representative Olson and remind the committee that he was also a member of the steering committee, and we very much appreciated his involvement and engagement. If you remember, the idea for the Juvenile Justice Symposium was born out of the 2009 legislative session. And the hope then was that the system could really come together, understand how the different parts of the continuum worked within the system, and really come up with a systems approach to managing juvenile justice in Oregon. Simply put, so that as we move forward with policy decisions and budget decisions, we were really coming forward as a system to all of you with ideas, as opposed to parts of the continuum bringing forth contradictory policy decisions or budget decisions. The symposium was actually a year in the making. 4 work groups came together with over 100 individuals in the juvenile justice system to look at data and research and really make a determination on what juvenile justice should look like, one, to be the most effective system as possible, but facing the budget situation that we're faced with, also the most efficient system that we could push forward as possible. There were 4 work groups that came together with overarching themes that are highlighted in the document before you, but they included stopping the transgenerational cycle of delinquent behavior, clarifying risk-based versus offense-based approaches, balancing an efficient and effective resource throughout the system, which I referred to earlier, and ensuring really that continuity of care and services as youth transition in and out of the system. Nearly 250 individuals then came to the actual symposium event in October. It was not a listening session. It really was a working session. The group was very active in engaging in conversation and coming up with potential outcomes. If you refer to the second page of your document, you can actually see the draft outcomes that the 250 individuals came together to propose. They include items such as improving youth opportunities for success, supporting victims' rights, maximizing our return on investment, expanding the use of science and data, and advancing professional development. Again, these are just draft strategies, so I'll talk quickly about next steps. The steering committee is hoping to create and finalize a report by the end of this month, and so we're very excited to be able to present those proposals back to you in a formal fashion. But out of the symposium efforts, one of the outcomes that I'd like to highlight is the steering committee really worked, especially with the assistance of Representative Olson, to reach out to the business community and begin the conversation of bringing both government and the private sector together. And so one of the items that I'll highlight for next steps is that the Oregon Commission on Children and Families have agreed to sponsor a half-day meeting in Bend to bring together those public and private sector partners to discuss ways that we can work together to create those positive outcomes for youth. And I would like to recognize Dick Withnell, a local businessman and youth advocate who really pushed this idea forward and is really helping us in achieving that, that outcome. The steering committee has agreed in some form or fashion to live beyond the symposium to continue to ensure that these outcomes and the goals highlighted really receive that follow-through and come to fruition, but also so that we continue to have this forum for policy and budget decisions to be thought through in an effective way as a system and as we move forward with that systems approach. So with that, I will turn it over to Chair Barry to add any comments, and if none, we would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
How about I just say ditto? That was I indicated to Director Peters that as we were discussing just getting this out and being quick before you, that I would be happy to be the potted plant, and so I'll take that role unless there are questions.
Okay.
A potted barrel.
Well, and you need to introduce yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Brad Berry. I'm Yamhill County District Attorney, and I've chaired the Juvenile Justice System Symposium Steering Committee.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just note, I'm the juvenile delinquency prosecutor for Josephine County. And so I was not able to attend the symposium, but coming from the trenches of the juvenile justice system, anybody here who voted for this, thank you. It's an excellent idea. I'm very, very happy that these issues are being discussed in this manner and that there's such a high level of interest. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Anything further?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just want to mention these two were really intricate pieces, I mean, in getting this whole thing done this past year. And they, you know, their leadership really was great. Looking forward to the future, what's happening in the juvenile justice system because of it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Surety bail, is that bail? Is surety bail the only thing left there?
Excuse me.
The bail's the only issue left.
Sure, if you like. I believe the bar's here to report, too, so on family law issues.
What happened to Menahan?
I'm sorry, Tom.
Parenting?
That's what I'm sorry, Kozanski just stepped out of the room for a bit, but I don't think he
worked. Mr. Chair, we're lost without you. Did you get the not the revised?
There is one more. Next to the reports establishing and enforcing parenting plans. And Matt, I see Matt's here, and David Gannett. Wants to go first?
Between Mr. Mahan and myself, I'll go first. And sure. You want to do the follow-up?
Absolutely.
Point, counterpoint. Chair Podansky, I don't see Chair Barker here, but thank you for letting us come back and report. I am David Gannett. I'm a private practice attorney in Portland. My specialty is family law. I am the chair of the legislative subcommittee of the family law section of the Oregon State Bar. At the end of last session, an interim committee asked the bar, family law section, to create a committee that would look at parenting plans. This was inspired by House bills that Mr. Minahan introduced in session 2009, addressing some of the questions that Mr. Minahan had on existing law, as well as some proposals that did not pass in the 2009 session. The committee was composed of other family law attorneys, people from the Attorney General's Office, Margaret Olney in particular, Leslie Harris of the Law School at the University of Oregon. As we conduct our meetings, we began with inviting Mr. Minahan and people that he was aware of that had problems in the state of Oregon with parenting plans, as well as people that had ideas of what was happening outside the state of Oregon, to give us ideas about establishing parenting plan and enforcement. Mr. Minahan had some excellent ideas that we agreed with in part, and there were some ideas that we didn't agree with in part. In essence, our work group believes that establishing and enforcing parenting plans is a problem, definitely. The public needs more assistance in coming up with terms to put in their parenting plans, which are required by statute, so that there's truly a meeting of the minds and there are details that can be enforced and expectations put on paper. A lot of the problems we see is when people would say something is mutually agreed. We used to use the term about 15, 20 years ago, reasonable and seasonable visitation, that didn't have any specifics of which people would understood they would be expected to comply with, and the courts had nothing to enforce. Therefore, we had the evolution of parenting plans. We believe even more, the group believes even more assistance is necessary in coming up with very good assistance to people on the specifics of what they're going to put into their judgment, be it non-parent parents or people going through a divorce, that the court can find what is happening, hold people accountable. They can also work from an existing relationship and take in change of circumstances and modify if a court needs to rule. If there's mediation, there's something for the mediator to start out with where the parents are working to begin with and what needs to change thereafter. That's on the establishing of the parenting plans. We had some recommendations in it about how to use Oregon Judicial Department resources, how we could have people that are basically below judges assisting the administrative level or on the court staff level to assist the public. Why are we looking at self-representative people here? The ones with attorneys are not so much at a disadvantage as those who are self-represented, which by the figures that I have, and by the way, I'm a temporary judge as well as a practicing attorney, is that we're looking at 40% of cases have at least one unrepresented party, 70% of the cases have one or two unrepresented parties. So we're looking at a huge portion of the caseload that does have no representation. Besides the establishment, we're also looking at the enforcement. We believe in the work group that Oregon has some very good laws about remedies. The problem is getting these cases to the point where there's actually timely remedies occurring. And we agree very much so with Mr. Mahan and his group that one of the biggest problems we're having is justice delayed, which is impacting parent-child relationships, it's impacting the children that are harmed because they're not having time with their dads or their moms. We have people that feel that they agree to something, but they know that the consequences of failing to comply literally are months away before you get to a judge. By then your facts are stale, the impetus dries up a bit to do something serious to correct the problem, as well as what can you do retroactively for missed parenting time. So we're looking at what can we do to get people in front of judges or an administrative law judge somehow quicker. And I want to point out something specific that came from Margaret Only when she was with the Attorney General's office. We looked at the state of Texas. In the child support program there, and Margaret said the same here for Oregon, is that when you've got a gap between people getting effective parenting time and child support, child support collections go down. There is a known correlation that child support collections are much more effective when you have people that are practicing their parenting plan. There's no withholding issues that are going on. There's no modification of parenting plan issues. And when looking at Texas, they do have an arrangement where the child support program has the ability to address enforcement and modification issues on parenting plans. The challenge is that federal money explicitly cannot be used for parenting time. So I believe what they do in Texas is they have state funds. That's a solution that we're not proposing, but we look at that they have recognized a problem that we're facing, and that's the way they've chosen to deal with that problem. And their collections, as reported by Margaret Only, went up because there was more satisfaction with the people and they're dealing with the state and they're dealing with the parenting plans. It was that breadth of examination that we took to the subject. We also saw that there were these particular problems, some that we could identify in this state as well in other states. And we just make these broad recommendations, there's no proposed legislation, of aspects of parenting plans that may be relevant come some sort of proposed legislation in the 2011 session. Matt, please.
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, for the record, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent Dads America and Oregon Association of Children's and Family Services here in Oregon. First, let me say I want to thank the members of the committee and the Oregon State Bar for taking the time to analyze this issue. As you can see from your handouts, I submitted a number of areas that we felt needed improvement that the bar kind of discussed. Unfortunately, we weren't overly pleased with the report from the State Bar. We truly feel there are areas in Oregon law that could be improved with legislation. And our main goal here is to maximize visitation from both parents. Although I represent parents groups, our real focus here is the children. And we have a number of studies that show how important it is to have involvement from both parents. And I truly believe in my heart we can introduce legislation that will maximize involvement from both parents and reduce conflict in some high conflict cases. I'm the first to admit House Bill 3402 was extremely broad and it had a number of technical issues. I have worked with my group and we have pared that down significantly. And we're certainly prepared to bring forth a proposal in 2011 that I think you'll agree is a pared down and focus. And I don't think this is an end-all, this report, and our work is certainly not an end-all. It's an ongoing process, and both sides agree that I think there'll be some more work and some compromise discussions, and that we can bring something forward next session that will resolve some of those issues that we feel need to be resolved. And I'm open for questions if anyone has any.
Great, thank you. Questions for either? Comments?
All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the update. Mr. Taylor, Bill, do you want to give us just a quick update?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have the issue that we've had before these committees on several occasions relates to bringing back in Oregon surety bail where there would be a bail bond. It came out of House Bill 2682 from last session. We have had about a dozen work group meetings during the interim. As I said, it's been before the committee four times. We have put a rough draft together. It's still a work in progress. It involves such issues as the insurance division as it relates to the insurance companies that would be behind the bonds. It involves the judicial department because it would significantly change part of the process that we have now. As you may know, we have, for lack of a better term, is a cash system where if the court decides that there is going to be bail, the person puts up 10% of what the court determines the bail should be. So if they say $10,000, the person puts up $1,000. This would be a bond instead. It involves DPSST as it relates to the issues of the bail recovery agent. It's extremely complicated legal question in the sense that literally in 1865, the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called Taylor in dicta said that because of the unique history of the United States as opposed to Oregon, where it was possible to disappear into the frontier, a bail recovery agent or a bounty hunter, another term for it, had the powers to cross state lines and to go into people's houses without a warrant to recover someone who had absconded. In 1971, Oregon did away with surety bail bonds and went to this cash system. In 1978, two bail recovery agents from California came up and took a guy out of Portland. They were charged with kidnapping, too. It went to the Court of Appeals. It was upheld. In very, very strong language by the Oregon Court of Appeals said that the common law as expressed by Taylor and followed by most of the states in the United States either by common law or by statute was not the law of Oregon. As a result, the conviction was upheld. As we worked through this process and put together the insurance division issues, the judicial department issues, and DPSST issues, one of the key issues was how much power should the person who's a bail recovery agent have? And that was one of the dicier points. The original draft said that they had a right to make an arrest. Well, anyone can make an arrest for a felony committed in their presence. But the issue became down, okay, what happens to someone's house? The cases I've read and the problems I've read in other jurisdictions, it seems that when people jump bail, the first place they go is to mummy's house. And there have been times when bail recovery agents have been a little bit rough with mom. I can well imagine that mom is going to defend her little boy with her life if she has to. And that's caused problems. And that's where we're still in the drafting process, is how to set forth the language around there and a couple of other issues as it relates to when bail should be forfeited. So you don't have a draft in front of you. Given the intensity around this issue, it was just felt that until we had it more in final form, it was better to keep working on it and to come into session with a draft at that point.
All right.
Chairman of the committee.
Yeah, let me just follow up on that. It is a work in progress. We chose not to have anything introduced. My goal was to open this up for a discussion, allow all sides to be heard. We have not had that opportunity to do that. What I expect will happen is when LC is provided with the additional language they need to get a draft in a final form, we will then have the interested parties that have raised concerns and such meet with those who are supporting this, so we can have a larger discussion in a work group setting, and then at that point decisions will be made as to what will or won't happen with a draft or a bill if it goes that far. And so that's kind of the update, and so it's nothing new else to really report on that except that it's still being considered, but nothing's moving forward until we have more finality with the drafting and feedback. All right, any other questions? Any other comments? Anything else that we need to do on the Senate side? All right, with that, the Senate's going, Interim Committee for Judiciary is going to adjourn today. And just for the record, look forward to working with all of us that will be back on the committee. I wish Senator Boquist would have been able to stay a little bit longer. He will not be joining us during the session. Senator Cruz will be coming forward and taking his place on the Judiciary Committee. And everyone be safe during the holidays. Have a great time with family, and we'll see you back after the first of the year.
And House Committee will be adjourning, and look forward to, hopefully, most people will be back. Judy was going to miss you. You're a great asset to the committee.
Yes, thank you. I'll miss it as well.